This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. Jim Turner on the 5th of December, 2001, at approximately 11:15 Lubbock time. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Turner is in Sacramento, California. Sir, why don't we begin with a brief discussion of your early life, and if you would, tell us when you were born, where you grew up.
I was born in Richmond, Virginia in 1947, and I was raised there, and until I went into the Army, I that's about as far as I travel.
Mm-hmm.
I went to high school there, graduated from high school, and from Manchester High School in Richmond, Virginia.
Okay. Now, were your parents, did they serve in the military or government service?
My grandfather served in World War I, and my father served in World War II.
Okay. Did either of them talk to you much about their experiences?
Yeah, some. You know, my grandfather served with the 80th Division in the Infantry
mm-hmm.
in France in World War I, and I think it was pretty intense combat
mm-hmm.
In that time. My father served in the Army Air Corps, the 9th Air Force,
mm-hmm.
with the B-25s, and flew out of England, then he was later in France, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, your grandfather, did he talk much about the specifics of his combat experience?
Yeah, but, you know, in my own experience, I think it's very difficult for someone to verbalize
mm-hmm.
what combat is truly like. I mean, they can tell you, but it's really difficult to give you the true experience of what combat is really like.
Mm-hmm.
I can recall one story that he told me that they were in France in trenches and it was raining pretty hard, and he'd gone to sleep in the trench, and when he woke up in the morning, the water running into the trenches were red with blood.
Mm-hmm.
So much fighting that had been going on the front lines.
Mm-hmm. And how about I assume he was there for the liberation and celebrations in France and
right.
and everything else that occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Did he talk much about the atmosphere, the attitude that Americans had, their concerns about the way the peace was structured at Versailles, anything like that?
No, I don't okay. think he, you know, I think he's like most lower-ranking soldiers those things are not anything that really concern you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I mean, you're mostly interested in getting home
mm-hmm.
or...
Absolutely.
Getting a shower and those kind of things, mm-hmm. and what they're doing in some place on a peace table, I don't think is very of much interest to you.
Understand that. How about your dad? Was did he convey much about his experiences?
Yeah, he told me quite a bit about what he did, as in the Air Corps. When they were over there,
mm-hmm.
told me a lot about England and places he'd been in England and France and different things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty interesting.
Did he stay in the service after the war, or did he get out?
No, he got out. Both my grandfather and my father both got out as soon as they were, released from the service after the war.
Mm-hmm.
And he went on. He became. He worked for. A company called A.B. Dick Company.
Mm-hmm.
They're no longer in existence now, but he worked there, I think, about 37 years for them. They made printing equipment and mimeograph machines, those type of things.
Mm-hmm. Now, did how much of an effect did your grandfather's and your father's military service have on you when the Vietnam War unfolded and you found yourself at draft age?
I think they had, a lot of effect on me because I had a lot of respect for both of them, and,
mm-hmm.
And I think that I wanted, I really, when I got out of high school, I really didn't have any I'd say, real direction that I was interested in going in at the time. And, and I thought it was a good way to maybe get some training, education, and you know, at that time, everybody served, so you figured you'd be going one sooner or later anyway.
But you chose to enlist,
mm-hmm.
not to be drafted.
Right.
Okay.
One of the reasons I think I chose to enlist was is that one of the things is that if you enlisted, you had a choice of occupation,
mm-hmm.
and plus, you know, you had some choice on destiny when you when you were going in. So I think that's really one of the reasons. Although I didn't go into the specialty that I wanted to go into,
mm-hmm.
but I was interested in law enforcement at the time, and I thought I'd like to become a MP.
Okay. And just to clarify, you enlisted in 1965.
Right. Uh-huh.
As you were getting ready to graduate from high school, when did you already know that you were going to go in the Army? Or
yes, uh-huh.
Okay.
Right.
Before that, I guess, say, as when you were a junior or maybe the beginning of your senior year in 1964, how much attention were you paying to some of the major events that occurred, you know, especially in August of 64, Gulf of Tonkin incident, things like that?
I don't think it had much effect on me at all. I don't even remember it.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think I even knew where Vietnam was,
mm-hmm.
to be honest
mm-hmm.
with you.
Okay.
I mean, I was interested in other things, you know,
mm-hmm.
kids
oh, yeah.
interested in having a good time. And you know, I knew guys in the Army, you know, got older guys. But I don't think I knew anybody that went to Vietnam at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even remember. I think the first time that I remember much about Vietnam must have been in 65.
Hmm.
You know, I just don't think I paid that much attention to it at the time. And it wasn't any discussion that I recall in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Not at that point.
Yeah. Did your parents talk much about politics with you?
Not too much. They weren't active politicians,
mm-hmm.
so to speak. I just remember my earliest remembrance of politics was I went down in the main street there in Richmond when I was a young kid, and I had a big button on "I like Ike," and
mm-hmm.
Eisenhower came down, and I was more impressed with the flares and sparklers than I was with Eisenhower. Although I can remember this day seeing him go by in his convertible waving to everybody.
Wow!
And I had the big old "I like Ike" button on,
uh-huh.
but I don't think my parents were. They weren't real active in politics, although they always voted. I remember.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, when you went to see the recruiter, why don't you go ahead and describe that? What was the exchange like?
Well,
how did you settle on your MOS?
Well, I went down to the federal building,
mm-hmm.
and met with the I think he was a master sergeant, and he had a chest load of ribbons and everything. I think he'd been in the Army a long time. In fact, I think he said he told me he had a battlefield commission and then was rifted after the Korean War or something back to enlisted, I think he said. But, you know, very friendly guy, and I told him what I wanted, and I wanted to be an MP. And so he set me up to go. He said, well, before I can do anything for you, you need to take the military test and all that sort of thing, and then I can tell you what I can offer you. So I went down, took the test, and I don't remember the time frames. You know, it was all within a couple of weeks there, I think. And I came back, and he told me that. He said, I think I've got something that you would be more interested in that's a better deal than going into the MPs. And so he sent me over to this office, and there was an Army intelligence office. And they interviewed me and told me all about Army intelligence and that kind of thing, and So I thought it sounded pretty good. And so I told him, yeah, that I'd be interested in enlisting for the intelligence. But I didn't go out specifically. I didn't even know anything about it. They pulled me out for it for some reason.
Did you ever find out the reason?
No. Okay. They don't tell you much there.
Okay. So how long after you went to the recruiter, how long did you have before you actually had to go to basic training?
I think it's like a month. I was still in high school, and when I graduated from high school, I was in the Army. I'd already been sworn in.
Wow.
And so when the night that I graduated from high school, I was on a train for basic training.
Okay. Well, what did your family think about your decision?
My mother wasn't very happy.
Okay.
My father didn't say too much, you know. He said, "Well, you know, good luck. And it's kind of tough and basic training, that kind of thing, you know." And my mother got used to it after a while. You know, I mean, she just at first, I think she was a little bit shocked that I'd made that decision. Maybe because I didn't say anything to him about it, you know, I just went in and did it.
Yeah.
But at that particular time, I don't think that Vietnam was a huge concern. You know, I just don't recall that much publicity about it. I'm sure there was, but of course, I didn't read the paper that much as a kid.
Yeah.
So I don't remember that much about it.
Okay. Well, did you think that you might find yourself in Vietnam?
I think after I got to basic training, I did.
Right.
You know, they sort of talked a lot about it there, you know, and it was, you know, I thought about it. Then I still didn't really know a lot about it. And just based on the training at, like, boot camp and that kind of thing, I don't think they knew a lot about it either.
Yeah.
I think most of them were used to, you know, a lot of guys that were doing the training were Korean War vets, that kind of thing.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and describe your bus ride to basic and then your first impressions, experiences in the active duty Army.
Well, I got on a train, and the train was full of soldiers coming down from New York and Pennsylvania, I think. Most of those guys on there were from Pennsylvania and New York. And when I got on the train, you know, this was towards the end of the passenger service for the railroads. And the train was not really in that good a shape. Seats were kind of worn and that kind of thing. And the train was just full of soldiers. And they were all on their way to basic training at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And we were on the train all night. And I remember they had a guy on there. Had a little small bar on that thing, and he was selling, I think he only sold beer in there. Man, that guy was selling so much beer. I don't even know how he carried so much beer. Selling all those guys. But anyway, we were on the train all night, and we got there, I think, in the afternoon, like early afternoon, 1 o'clock or something. I know it didn't sleep very well, and you know, just sitting up in this train. And then we got to there, and the guy got on, sergeant got on board and told us to get on the bus, and I ended up having to sit next to him on the bus. So I was asking, you know, what's the Army like, that kind of thing. He said, it's okay. He said, I'm getting out in 2 weeks or something. he had already served his time, I guess, and was ready to get out. And so then we caught the bus and rode, I don't remember, too far from the bus station to Fort Jackson, South Carolina. Of course, we got off, and I think everybody probably experienced the same thing. They're screaming at you, get off the bus, and getting off the bus. And then the first thing they did was, after we got there, is march us over to the barbershop and got haircuts, cut everybody's hair off. And at that time, it was early, and, you know, they didn't, not many people had those, you know, the long hair hairstyles, as they did a little later. You know, a little later, a lot of people wore long hair, but at that time, most people, most of the men there didn't have long hair. They just regular haircuts.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we stayed in this, it was a reception center. We were there for like 2 weeks, and we didn't have any, it took us a week to get uniforms. We were wearing the same clothes for a week. And then we finally were shipped out to our basic training company, and, you know, then they started the training.
What did you do during that week when you didn't have uniforms?
Well, we had on civilian clothes, and we had to fall out and march around, and they take us, got us ID cards, and, you know, took care of all the administrative work. Most of the time, we just sit around doing nothing, cleaning the barracks and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we, after we'd been there a while, a couple of guys were saying, hey, this is not too bad. That's because we weren't doing anything.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they weren't messing with us or anything at that uh-huh. point. And they, you know, we went and had physicals. I remember there was a guy who really wanted to be in the Army, and they gave us another physical there, just a sort of a mini physical. I think they wanted to make sure that the recruiters hadn't pushed somebody through who wasn't physically fit. And I remember one guy was missing a big toe. He had, in a hunting accident, he had shot off a big toe on his, one of his feet, I forget which one. And the doctors pulled him out and sent him home. They wouldn't let him stay in the Army. Said he was missing a toe. I guess maybe it's balance or something. I don't know. But I remember he didn't want to get out. He tried to talk the guy into letting him stay, and they wouldn't do it.
Okay. Well, so what happened when you finally did get into your regular basic training unit?
Well, we got there, and you know, we had these tall sergeants, you know, these thin guys that were in great shape, screaming at us and hollering, and, you know, and I was there about 15 minutes. I went, what in the heck am I doing here?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if mm-hmm. I made the right decision mm-hmm. or not.
Right.
But it was pretty tough, I think, you know, a lot of running. I was in fairly good shape then, and so the physical aspect of it was, even though it was hard, wasn't, you know, I mean, it wasn't, I was young, and I was in good shape, and so it didn't kill me.
Mm-hmm.
Some guys I saw that were really, especially guys that were overweight, it was really tough on them, you know, because they were overweight, and they were trying to make them run, and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I remember there was one guy there. He was a pretty good-sized guy, but I don't know if he was overweight, but he's big. And they'd tell him to give 50 push-ups, and he'd do them one-handed. Guy was unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he just really good, strong. He was just some guy from Baltimore, I remember. And we had a lot of guys from all different places, different races, and creeds, colors, and everything else in that unit.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think it was good training. It was good preparation for basic part of training.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you play sports in high school?
Played baseball.
Okay. What subjects did you like?
Let me see. I've always liked history.
Mm-hmm.
I was always interested in history.
Okay. But there wasn't anything that, I guess, would have interested you in high school that would have also drawn you eventually to intelligence?
No,
yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I never even thought about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what was the most challenging aspect of basic training for you?
Probably the mental part. You know, they put the mental stress on you, and I always liked to do well, you know, and it's hard to really excel in basic training. I mean, you know, they want you to be part of a team.
Mm-hmm.
You don't excel individually there, and so they, you know, it's tough. I think the you know, just the getting used to the discipline and that kind of thing is the hardest part for me, I think.
Okay, and you mentioned the very diverse nature of the basic training I guess, platoon that you went through training with. Were there any conflicts based on some of these differences?
No, never saw any.
Okay.
They were all, all the guys, I've got a, when you get out of basic training, you get this book, it's like a high school yearbook, I was looking through it here not long ago, a lot of different guys, it's, signed a book, black guys, Chinese guys, where I was from, in Virginia, of course, there were, a lot of African Americans in Virginia, but I don't think I'd ever met any Hispanic people or anything coming up. It just wasn't any that lived there at the time.
Okay. And what were the weapons that you trained on in basic?
M14 was the hand grenades and kind of that.
Mm-hmm.
But the rifle at that time was an M14.
Okay.
Which I actually liked. I thought it was better than the M16. More reliable.
The drill instructors, did they talk much about their own combat experiences? And of course, this being 65, you probably didn't have anybody who'd been to Vietnam, or did you?
I don't think so. I don't think any of those guys had been to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I know one of the guys had been in Korea. I think one of them had been in World War II. He was an old sergeant, and I know he used to yell at us every day, "I've been in this man's army 35 years, and I've hated every day."
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he was married. He'd come rolling into basic training at 5 o'clock in the morning, and you could tell he'd just come from downtown. He was a crusty old guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were the most memorable experiences you had in basic? Anything stand out?
Hmm. No, just to me, the most interesting part was meeting all the different people. Guys from all kinds of walks of life. I just thought that was very interesting because I didn't realize it at the time that I hadn't been exposed to very much. Raised in a suburb of Richmond, and I just hadn't these guys. Some of them from New York City, Baltimore. Farms in different places, and it was. I just thought that the diversity of the people there made it very interesting, and I always thought that it was a big mistake when they discontinued the draft, just from the point of having so many diverse people
mm-hmm.
within the military. I thought that made it. I thought it was better. I had guys in basic training. Some of them were going to some highly technical jobs. Some of them were going to infantry.
Mm-hmm.
And just the diversity of the people there just made it. It was a learning experience.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you remember what they emphasized about Vietnam during basic training?
Just mostly they said you go get killed there. That's about all I remember. Said half you guys be dead next year. If you don't pay attention to training and things
uh-huh.
like that.
Yeah.
But the training that they gave, not that it was their fault because we really hadn't committed many. I was in one of the first waves of troops to go in there, so they really didn't have a lot of experience. I just saw the difference because I spent quite a bit of time over there, and the difference even while I was there, it would just change dramatically.
But, mm-hmm.
I just don't think they had at that time they had the operational experience over there to really train you in basic training to be prepared for it.
Yeah. Well, when did you graduate from basic? And where did you go from there?
I guess I graduated July, I guess. And then I went from there. I went to Fort Holabird, Maryland, which is an intelligence training school.
Mm-hmm.
It's in Baltimore. And not there anymore. They closed it. But that was that was more like a college campus than it was a military fort. We had officers and enlisted men from all over the world, different military places being trained there in intelligence, and a lot of guys there. It was a very interesting place. Very nice post. One of the nicest posts I was ever stationed on.
Mm-hmm. When you say from around the world, you mean from different countries as well?
Uh-huh. Turkey. I can remember seeing guys from Turkey and guys from, all kind of places. Germany, France, different places.
Now, were these students in your classes as well?
No.
Okay.
I think they had separate classes for them.
Okay. But were you able to interact much with them?
Uh-huh.
When you were out of class?
Yeah, we could talk. You know, we'd see them around at the clubs and stuff downtown too. Sometimes
everybody seemed to get along well.
Yeah, right. I'd say most of the guys that were there, or most of the American students. Well, I'm sure the foreign students, especially, but most of the American students were college graduates. It was like just more college classes for them, I think.
And why don't you go ahead and describe how your routine changed? You know, what was it like at AIT? What was your average day like there?
Well, let's see. We went most of the time was spent in classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
We were in classrooms a lot for the first part of the class, first part of the training. Most of the time, we just spent a lot of time in classroom lectures and that kind of thing. And then later, let's see, we went through some POW training type things on how to react if you're captured, what to do, what to say, that kind of thing. They took us through some jungle training, that kind of, just different things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of interrogation and just a wide variety. It was a really interesting class, actually. I enjoyed it.
Well, do you remember what they emphasized would be your principal job as an intelligence enlisted man? You know, what would you be doing in an MI unit?
Oh, we were, there's actually two different kinds of... At that time, it's much different now, but at that time, there were basically two sections to military intelligence. There was counterintelligence, which involved investigation of espionage, those type things, and investigation of backgrounds, doing background investigations on people who were applying for security clearances. And then there was the collections end, which was the actual collection when you were in a foreign country collecting intelligence against the enemy or whoever you were targeted at. And so actually when we, they didn't really train us for one specific job in Vietnam. I mean, it was just the intelligence job, and I was in the collections end of it, where you collect intelligence. I wasn't in the counterintelligence end of it, although I did work in counterintelligence when I came back from Vietnam.
Okay. Well, do you recall what the instruction you received there at Holabird would have emphasized with regard to how you collect intelligence, you know, the techniques, things like that?
Yeah, they use basically the Americans use a little bit different system than, say, the KGB, Russians, those type guys.
Mm-hmm.
The Americans use what they call an agent-handler type system. In other words, you recruit someone to go gather the actual intelligence and debrief them when they come back. That's generally, in very, very broad terms, that's basically what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And where the KGB, on a lot of cases, the KGB, although they operate the same way, they also use a lot of actual KGB agents to actually go and collect the actual information.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they put them in undercover and that kind of thing. The U.S. did that too some, but they were more limited than I would say most foreign intelligence were.
Mm-hmm.
They always, the key part of the training, I think, was plausible denial.
Mm-hmm.
No matter whatever you did, the United States had to be able to deny it.
Okay.
That's what they drilled into your head.
Yeah. Now, did they were things like blackmail, things like that, ever discussed?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there's
as
all
techniques for turning people.
Mm-hmm. Money. Well, everyone usually has a weakness.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, they just they teach you how to to explore those weaknesses, whatever they might be.
Mm-hmm. But how do you identify them? Did they talk about that?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's just. Most people are influenced by money,
mm-hmm.
and it's generally the way that they operate the most, although blackmail and those kind of things, whatever pressure that you could put on them,
mm-hmm.
Whatever you could identify
mm-hmm.
as having those problems.
Now, in this capacity, do they say you would typically find yourself in a non-hostile, that is a country that we're not engaged actively in war, against that country, but we want intelligence on them, or would you be doing this in a combat environment?
Well, one thing they teach you is espionage is illegal in every country in the world. there is no legal espionage. So,
right.
they had agents all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could have been. I didn't know where I was going to be assigned. Germany or. There were a lot of agents in Germany at the time that were, in the Cold War thing,
mm-hmm.
doing a lot of Russian stuff,
mm-hmm.
sending people across the border into Czechoslovakia, East Germany, and those kind of things.
Yeah.
And, recruiting people who went back and forth. I mean, a lot of that stuff, Korea, there was still a lot of stuff going on in Korea,
yeah.
intelligence, and, everywhere. I mean, those guys went every place, and the counterintelligence guys, I don't know of any town or city in this country at the time that didn't have an Army intelligence agent stationed in it.
Hmm.
I mean, they had guys at every town. I mean, they had what they call resident agents that they'd be maybe working at a post office building or something.
Okay.
But well, I don't think they do that anymore. They cut all that out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, how long was this training?
I think I was there, let's see. October. I was there about 4 months, I think, 4 or 5 months.
Okay. And how thorough do you think it was?
Oh, I thought it was excellent. Excellent training. Very, very good. It's a big fraternity.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You can never get rid of those guys. I hear from them all the time.
Uh-huh.
Well, I'm the chairman of our association.
Oh, okay.
So, not for the whole Army intelligence, just one unit.
Okay.
The one I was assigned to in Vietnam.
Okay. Well, did you know where you were going to go when you graduated?
When we graduated, they told us that day when we graduated where we were going.
Okay.
We had choices. They gave us choices. And I volunteered to go to Vietnam.
Oh, you did?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, upon graduation from intelligence school, were they going to send you to language school?
Yeah, they were going to send us to Monterey,
uh-huh.
to the Defense Language Institute
okay.
there. And anyway, they sent me there, but I was there to a very brief, abbreviated course. I
okay.
guess they were really short of intelligence people at that time,
yeah.
and they I went over there and spent about like a month, which was enough to learn nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just enough to get by.
Yeah.
I learned more in the local bars.
Yeah.
I did, but they sent me out there for like for a 30-day class. I don't know, maybe a 30-day class. It might not even been that long.
Huh.
It was a very short, abbreviated course.
Yeah.
Gave me some books and stuff, you know, should study it, but it's hard to pick up a language that way.
Yeah. So, well, when you were going through the intelligence courses, then they knew that some of you were going to Vietnam.
Oh, yeah. I'd say, two-thirds of our class went.
Okay. What did they cover as far as conducting military intelligence operations in Vietnam? Did they have anything?
Nothing.
Other than the
POW stuff.
That is, if you were captured, or?
Yeah, if you were captured, and there was some of that, and then interrogation of POWs.
Okay.
You know, how you get intelligence from them.
Right.
And there was some jungle stuff. I remember they gave us some jungle training there and that kind of thing, just briefly.
Okay.
But it's mostly, I would say that the classes there were mostly on methods and techniques of intelligence gathering.
Right.
Not so much, and that's the same wherever you go, whether you go Vietnam, Korea, Germany, whatever. It's really not that much difference.
So you, from your experience and also from your training, there wasn't too much of a need to discuss the cultural distinctions between some of the places?
Yeah, they did some, but it's usually you get that in country.
Okay.
When you get there, the unit would give you, because it's still, I don't think there's much difference.
Okay.
When it comes to gathering intelligence, it's close to the same. A little, you know, it's different some things, but you can pick that up in country.
Okay. What about interrogation techniques? Do they discuss different strategies for interviewing or interrogating Vietnamese versus Europeans, Western Europeans versus Eastern Europeans? Were there no distinctions that were made? Or
no, I didn't see any difference.
Okay.
I don't think they went into that detail.
Yeah. Okay. Well, when you graduated, did you feel...
I wasn't really... We had also people who specialized in interrogation.
Uh-huh.
And, I wasn't an interrogator, so to speak. This is just an event that you happened to be there and started the interrogation. But we had actual interrogators who that's all they did.
Uh-huh.
And so they probably had a lot more detail.
Yeah. Well, what did they cover, or how did they discuss some of the more controversial things about interrogations and handling POWs, enemy POWs? For instance, what did they say about torturing? Besides the fact that it's illegal.
Yeah, I never even heard any discussion of it, to be honest with you. I mean, I never even, when I was in the field, I never saw any of it. Generally, interrogation is a coercion.
Uh-huh.
After I was out of the service and everything, I became in law enforcement, and I retired from law enforcement. And I used to teach interrogation in police academies, and interrogation is, no matter what, it's not supposed to be coercion, but it is always coercion. Because you never have anyone who's going to say, if it's a crime, give me life in prison and I'm going to tell you everything. You know, I mean, it's not going to happen. And it's not a matter of using physical force against them. In fact, I think it's the wrong thing to do, because what you do is you'll get the guy to say anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they'll say anything to stop you from beating them up,
right.
And whether it's true or not. So then you don't get a real true picture.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, you can get, you get the good guy, bad guy thing. But that doesn't necessarily require physical violence. You know, one guy's nice, one guy's not.
Mm-hmm.
And usually you can pick out what a, suspect or a prisoner who he likes. And so then you just play the roles.
Okay.
But generally speaking, I always, my experience with the VC prisoners or North Vietnamese prisoners, I mean, they just freely gave the information. They just, they were scared or they were just glad to be, because their treatment in prison was much better than what they were getting at in the field.
Uh-huh.
So they were just glad to be there, I think.
Huh. Okay. Did they discuss things like the Geneva Convention?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They talk to some of, you know, they tell you about all that stuff. Especially for your own sake if you're captured.
Yes.
But generally speaking, the Geneva Convention is questionable whether it applied to some military intelligence, because you were there as an espionage agent, not as a military personnel. So it's questionable whether you were even covered.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we had four guys captured by North Vietnamese, and two of them were held in prison camps for a long time. And I think I'm not sure. It took them a long time to figure out who they were, but they finally did. And they captured them and a CIA agent around the same time during the Way Offensive '68.
Okay.
And they stayed in prisons, in North Vietnamese prison camps. Two of them escaped on the way to North Vietnam.
Wow.
And I think they were the only two to ever escape out of captivity. And they escaped, and then the other two didn't get away, and they were taken up until in North Vietnam until the end of the war.
The two that escaped, they made it back to their American units, okay?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Yeah.
And the other two, they were eventually released with other prisoners?
Yeah. Yeah, both of them were released. Okay. They weren't kept together. The three, they were captured in Way.
Okay.
And they were taken up, and the two that escaped, I got their names somewhere, but they escaped and got back to the Marine unit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, when you graduated from intelligence school, did you feel well prepared for what you might find yourself doing in Vietnam and elsewhere?
Yeah, I thought so. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the experience, but I felt prepared to do the job.
Mm-hmm. And when you went to Monterey to that month-long language class, who was teaching that?
Some Vietnamese woman. I don't remember her name, but I remember it was a woman, Vietnamese woman. And I know she was saying, "Well, we can't teach you in 30 days."
Yeah.
But they did talk a lot about cultural things, you know, like mm-hmm. that, which I thought was more valuable than the actual language.
Do you recall anything in particular, mm-hmm. as far as the cultural education you received there?
Just the way, you know, the people acted, the way they thought, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. I still remember.
Okay. Any cultural do's or don'ts that you recall? You know, things mm-hmm. you shouldn't do in Vietnam, for instance? Things that Vietnamese people take offense to, that kind of stuff?
I'm sure they did, I just don't remember.
Okay.
I just don't remember. I'm sure that they told, because I know there were some things that, you know, they didn't, that they could be offended, and, you know, if certain things that we do is normal may offend the Vietnamese. I don't remember, though, exactly what they were. I wasn't there long enough to really even get much information.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when did you leave Monterey?
I left there. And that was right on my way going to Vietnam,
because mm-hmm.
I left there and went to Travis Air Force Base and caught a plane over to Vietnam from there.
Okay.
So I don't even know if I was there 30 days. It might have been like 2 or 3 weeks,
mm-hmm.
it seems like to me. It wasn't very long. It was more like a orientation class, I thought, because most of the guys were there like for a year.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the guy that I was stationed with over there, he had been there for a year, and he could really reel it off. He was a really good interrogation guy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, language guy. He could just really speak the language.
Mm. Okay. Well, and again, month and year for that?
Oh, I left there in November of 65.
November of 65?
That's okay. When I left to go to Vietnam.
Did you get any leave time before you went to Vietnam?
Yeah, between when I went to Hollabird and before I went to California.
Oh, okay. Okay. What did your folks think about you going to Vietnam?
I think they were worried.
Yeah.
You know, by this time there was a lot of information going on about it. You know, a lot of news, and there was a lot of terrorist activity going on. You know, in the news, and basically because there wasn't that many full military units there. So.
Mm-hmm. And any last minute pieces of advice from your father, as far as you know.
Just be careful.
Yeah, okay.
That's all I remember.
Yeah.
Because he was in a different kind of a...
Yeah, he was in the air war.
Yeah, he was in the air.
How about your grandfather? Was he still alive then?
Yeah.
Did you get to talk to him before you left?
Yeah, I talked to him. And the interesting part about was my grandmother.
Mm.
She was a... she was, I don't know what you would call her. She was anti-war. she was anti, not just Vietnam, she was anti any war. She
yeah.
was still talking about World War I.
Uh-huh.
We shouldn't have been.
Wow.
So she was, very much opposed to the military and
uh-huh.
that kind of thing. She just, I don't know, she was just, she was a very religious woman.
Uh-huh.
And I think possibly, you know, I guess... I don't know. She just didn't think war was right, and sending young men off get killed and all that kind of stuff. You
mm-hmm.
know, she'd seen two wars already, three wars, I guess. She was born 1900. So, she was, her and I used to argue about it all the time. about the war, different wars. But, she was against it, man. She was saying, yeah, some guys are going to Canada, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
But, she was pretty much of a, I don't know what you call it, peacenik.
well,
she wasn't a demonstrator or
yeah.
anything, but, I mean, she just didn't like war. She was just against the war.
Would you say she was a pacifist?
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
Yeah, she was a pacifist, I think.
Okay. Well,
she didn't have any idea what I was doing, but...
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and describe what it was like going to Vietnam? What was the flight over like?
Well, I was in civilian clothes. We were traveling on civilian orders, and I was by myself. And... I went on a military charter flight. It was a Continental flight. And I was the only guy there on civilian clothes. And it was just a long flight, as I remember. I mean, I didn't think we'd ever get there. It just, we stopped in Hawaii. And let's see. We stopped in another place, Hawaii, Guam, I think. I think we stopped in Guam. And then went on into Vietnam. But I never could figure out how long it takes to fly over there. I mean, because you're changing days and times. And
yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I never really tried to calculate it exactly. But yeah. Whenever I think about it, I couldn't figure it out because it... so much change, and I'd be adjusting my watch, you know, as we're going along, you know,
oh, yeah.
We'd stop someplace, and somebody says it's like 30-some hours or something. I don't know. I remember it was a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, you're just sitting there. There's the first flight that I took, because I went across there several times, that Continental flight was pretty nice. I mean, they had movies, they had stewardesses on there, and then all of these troops, you know, on there. But it was a very nice, it was just like a commercial flight with movies, magazines, and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very nice the time I went over there, that time,
mm-hmm.
although it was very, very long. And then when I got to, I guess the first thing I remember when I got to Vietnam was the heat. I mean, when they opened that door, it's like a furnace. I mean, it was so hot and humid, and I was in a suit. But, you know, nobody had given me any information that it was 150 degrees over there. And, man, it was hot. I just remember that. So, anyway, I got off the plane, and I see this sergeant. He's got all these other guys that are on the plane in uniform forming up into a formation and marching on. I said, this doesn't look like the place I want to go. They look like they were going to someplace, you know, and I don't know what the process and some.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I walked on away. There was a little shack there on the side of the runway, and it was an Air Force. I think they were shipping and receiving or something like that. I think they took cargo or something. So I went in there and talked to that guy, and I was assigned to this unit. It was kind of a secret unit over there, supposedly, and their real name was, they were Detachment I of the 500th Military Intelligence Group, I think. Or intelligence group, some MI group, I think it was. It was a 500th MI group, Detachment I. And their code name over there was SMIAT, S-M-I-A-T, Special Military Intelligence Activities Team. And they had been over there since the 50s, conducting all kinds of intelligence. And they were also advisors to the 924 support group, which was the South Vietnamese Army's intelligence group. So they worked in conjunction with them. And so I went over and I figured, oh, this guy's not going to know this unit. How am I going to? I mean, nobody even knew I was coming. So I get over there, and as soon as I say to the guy, this Air Force sergeant, I remember sitting in there, I said, I'm assigned a SMIAT. I said, you know, oh, yeah, I know this guy. He calls the guy up on the phone. And so they just send a guy out. The sergeant major comes out, picks me up in the Jeep, and takes me down. And I go into this, he said, well, why don't you go get settled, get yourself some rest and all that, and put your gear up and all that. Well, they were putting me up in this big villa, and a beautiful place. It had all kinds of, they had a houseboy, they had a woman that did the cooking, they had a woman did the cleaning and laundry.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I forget now how much it was, but it seemed like to me it was like $20 a month you tossed in, and then you got all of this stuff with it, food. They took care of the food and everything. And so I said, man, this is this is not like what I just saw. You know, when you first land in Vietnam, you look out the window and you see all these guys sitting around in sandbag bunkers with machine guns, and they're dirty and they're hot. And you think, Jesus, man, this looks nasty.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go from that to a nice, beautiful villa. I thought, man, this is pretty nice. And I hooked up with a roommate there. Guy's name was Richard Mansfield. He still lives. He lives down in Long Beach, California now. He had been there since 64, I think, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of showed me the ropes and told me what was going on, what to do, and that kind of thing. And then I went to finally started work. We had this just outside of on the border, or on a, I guess the suburbs of Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
We had a an installation there that we shared with the 924 support group, and it was kind of an isolated place and fenced in area, and that's where our main headquarters was at that time. And we had, oh, I don't know how many people stationed there. Maybe 50 guys. I don't know. Maybe not even that many.
Mm-hmm.
But some of those, that, I remember there was one guy there who had been there since 1957.
Wow.
He'd been there all this time. He had married some Vietnamese woman, and he just, you know, kept re-enlisting and staying there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whatever happened to that guy after I left headquarters. I never did mm-hmm. keep track of him. But they had been around a long time, and, you know, I think they were involved some kind of way in the assassination of the South Vietnamese Prime Minister.
President Zim?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
right. Zim.
And his brother?
Yeah, I think somehow or another. That, I don't know whether they were involved in it or they knew about it and ignored it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the 924th support group was involved in it some kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
When you say 50 guys, you're talking about just the headquarters or are you talking about SMEOT generally?
SMEOT altogether had like 200 people in country.
Okay.
And they were really overworked because they, at that time, they were the only intelligence operation, army intelligence operation in the country.
Mm.
I mean, they were covering the whole country with like 200 guys. And it was a lot of work,
yeah.
A lot going on. And they were trying to get these intelligence reports out as fast as they could, and
mm-hmm.
it was pretty tough.
Yeah.
But what they did with me was I was there in headquarters, and they assigned me to a desk, each region. There were four regions in the country. And they assigned me to a region, and I reviewed the reports and made sure they went to the right units, distributed them, and that kind of thing. And it's a way of getting you used to what's going on in that region so that if they assign you to that region in the field, you would know what the current intelligence was and what they were collecting and that kind of thing. And then, you know, somehow or another, all this stuff went to an analyst, and I don't know, they did all kind of stuff with the information, put it to, correlated it with other things and stuff. But basically, mine was just reviewing the raw reports coming in.
When you say raw reports, you mean these are field reports that are being sent back to the headquarters from agents in the field? Or?
Right, uh-huh.
Okay.
What they call raw intelligence, which mm-hmm. is intelligence that's not necessarily verified
right.
by any other source. And they, you know, what they do is they had a headquarters. They had some other place there that they would put all of these together, aerial recon photos, reports from combat units, and all that kind of thing. And then they'd put them all together and try to make a complete picture of what the intelligence actually was.
Mm-hmm.
That's why intelligence is kind of slow. Mm-hmm. I mean, because you have to have so much to really make sure that it's valuable intelligence. It's you need to verify it some kind of way because you're dealing with unsavory people most
yeah.
of the time anyway.
Yeah.
So.
Well, what was the mission of SMEA? I mean, what was the goal? What was the?
Well, I think the official.
Mm-hmm.
I think the official mission of SMEA was to advise the 924 support group, which was the South Vietnamese Army intelligence unit,
mm-hmm.
and they were their advisors.
Okay.
And but they also collected intelligence on their own, also, you know, that was separate from their advisory status, I think.
Wait, you mean SMEA collected intelligence on their own?
Uh huh. Yeah, they. More than just advising. I mean, they had their own intelligence networks also.
Mm-hmm. And this was information that they then shared with MACV or something?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They sent it up to General, what's the general's name? Joe Christian.
Okay.
He's still alive, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I get an email from him every once in a while.
Do you really?
Yeah, he's up in his 80s.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Joe McChristian, he ran it up until 60 sometimes.
Uh-huh.
But they were in a transition period in December of 65.
Okay.
The 519th Military Intelligence Group, Battalion
mm-hmm.
came in by ship. They brought them into Vietnam. And the 525th Military Intelligence Group, which was their mother organization, came in, and I'd say the first part of 1966, they took over responsibility for all intelligence gathering in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to make it get away from the sort of undercover intelligence deal like they had going with the SMEAT,
mm-hmm.
and make it into more of a organized military intelligence organization.
Mm-hmm.
And then what they did was they merged us in the 500th into the Company C of the 519th Military Intelligence Battalion. And although the jobs didn't change or anything, they brought in all these military things and set up this big military post out in outside of Saigon, and
mm-hmm.
you know, just kind of turned it into a military operation.
Yeah.
And we were pretty quickly moved out of our villas.
What did you think about that transition, moving away from basically creating a spy network to more conventional military intelligence activities?
I didn't like it at the time because, I had it pretty easy there,
mm-hmm.
you know, the way it was. There wasn't very much military stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
But and they were turning it more back into military. But, I think looking at it now, I'm sure it was necessary. They didn't have the resources with the small unit to take care of the intelligence gathering they needed.
Uh-huh.
So actually the jobs didn't change much. They had more people.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as they started getting a lot of military in there, I started pressing to go into the field. I wanted to get away from them.
Okay.
And, those guys were, we were undercover. We were driving Studebakers and Renaults and all kinds of civilian vehicles,
mm-hmm.
wearing civilian clothes. And these guys come in, man, they're wearing fatigues and driving
yeah.
army jeeps and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I started pushing to get assigned out in the field, so I'm not sure when it was, but I did get sent to the Central Highlands in a town called Dalat,
mm-hmm.
and a beautiful old place,
mm-hmm.
and they had a nuclear power plant there, and real nice lake in front of the town. And gosh, it was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I went up under the cover as a university professor, and I was teaching at the University of Dalat. And I did teach a class there, but then the rest of the time we were doing some training of some Monyards to take up to Quezon.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can't remember how long I was there. Maybe a couple months.
What did you teach?
At night. I taught mostly at night. It was a night class.
Yeah, but what subject?
Oh, taught English.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Vietnamese English. It was very easy. I think anyway, you could have taught a monkey to teach his class. It was because they had all the books
mm-hmm.
and the teaching aids. I don't know where they got all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Some guy developed it. But you could just go in, you gave everybody the books, and you just pronounce the words for them, and you know, they had pictures and all that kind of stuff. It was very simple.
Okay.
And very nice people. I really enjoyed it, meeting a lot of the people. Mm-hmm. And
let me take you back to SMEA real quick. When you mentioned that it went more military, did the techniques, the intelligence gathering techniques, change at all?
No.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. No, it was. Because SMEAT really just changed names. The organization stayed the same. We just moved into
okay.
Company C of the 519. And then we got a lot more people, and then, you know, they started doing a lot more things in the administrative end than they had done before. Like, we had, like, a friend of mine, he lives in Salinas, California now. He was over there at the same time, and they had him cross-checking names of sources to different reports.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, when Cal Key had a, you know, had reported on some piece of information in one place, and then on another report his name picked up another, they would cross-reference them and that kind of thing, make sure that he was telling the same story,
mm-hmm.
and not milking two or three different agents at the same time,
mm-hmm.
you know, for money.
Yeah.
So the biggest thing that happened with it, that I remember, this is, I think, still when Smeot was still in control. I was reviewing reports, and this report came across that desk. President Johnson and Win Kao Ki had, this is when Win Kao Ki was the premier, had met in Hawaii over something about the war, I guess. They were just, you know, mm-hmm. But I guess Johnson was chewing him out about something that they weren't doing what he wanted them to do or whatever. But the Army intelligence had bugged the room and had transcripts of the whole conversation between Win Kao Ki and Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow Smeot had gone over and bugged the, while they did it, I don't know. I guess they just wanted to know what was going on. They bugged the room for the President of the United States. And then when they came back, they... I thought, I was reading this report, and I took it in today. We had a colonel there at the time. I don't remember his name, but he's an old guy. He'd been there a long time. He's about ready to retire. So I took it in, and I said, "Colonel, what am I supposed to do with this?" He saw that. He said, "I'll take care of it."
Wow.
But we were pretty informal, you know. This Smeot was a small unit, and we just reported directly to the CEO, who was
uh-huh.
a colonel at the time.
Uh-huh.
And officers and enlisted men, they just all did the same job.
Well,
I mean, it wasn't really any differentiated at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought, I said, man, they went and bugged the President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But they did a lot of operations back then.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like the intelligence, the flow of intelligence coming in into the Smeot headquarters was rather considerable.
Oh, yeah. There was a lot.
How was it organized, and how was it cross-referenced, and were there any rudimentary computers being used or anything
like
that?
No computers. And you know, I've never seen a report. In fact, I've got a friend who, and you may have run across him in doing Vietnam War research, is Jay Veit, what's his last name?
Veit, yes.
Yeah, does the POW stuff.
Uh-huh.
I've talked to him a couple times, and he talked about me, and he's told me, he said that he's never found written reports prepared or done by Smeot.
Huh.
And the only thing that I can, they were a pretty secret organization, I guess, but, I mean, I didn't think it was that secret. I mean, we were all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
But they used to prepare their reports on, do you remember those old blue ink Ditto machines?
Oh, yeah.
That's how they produced their reports. Well, those things fade away after a while.
Yeah.
And I don't know what they did with the report. I know we used to distribute them. We had a distribution list. We sent them, like, to 5th Special Forces, MACV, you know, I don't know. We had different ones,
mm-hmm.
General I Corps or something like that. But, you know, they were all on that Ditto machine stuff. And I don't know whatever happened to all of that stuff when the 519th took over. I don't know, you know, because I really wasn't in that end of it. When I was first there in Saigon, I worked a desk, the I Corps desk, and I'd read the reports as they came in, see if there's any urgent need to take care of something right away, or just routine distribution, or bring it to attention of somebody else, or whatever. But somebody else got them after me and did some admin work with them, I guess, you know,
okay.
correlated the information other places. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I know he told me one time he never had found any reference to the unit. And when I was talking to this guy, he was from the Special Forces about 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
He called me, and he knew a lot of SMEOT guys because a lot of the SMEOT guys were stationed with the Special Forces camps.
Mm-hmm.
And he said a lot of that stuff was just destroyed. You know, I guess this guy collects a lot of that stuff. And in our association, the only reports that we've ever found, intelligence reports, were from the 519th. So I don't know what happened to SMEOT's record.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. 924th might have taken them. I don't know.
Okay.
I just really don't know what happened to them. Okay. They were out of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Our headquarters was in Tokyo.
Okay.
And so I don't know what happened to them. I don't know what happened to the... They had been there for so long that maybe they, you know, I'm sure they didn't want anybody to know they were there
mm-hmm.
in the 50s.
Okay. I had a few more questions about your earlier experience in SMEOT. In particular, when you arrived there, what kind of briefings did they give you?
Mostly informal. It was... I recall, mainly what they did is they assign you to another agent, and then he briefs you pretty much on what's going on in the country and that kind of thing.
Well, when you arrived in Vietnam, what did you think was going on there?
You mean in the whole country?
Yeah. And what was the United States trying to accomplish, as far as you understood at the time?
I think, you know, I just it was mostly a terrorism campaign at the time when I got there, where they were blowing up hotels and restaurants, just terrorist activities, very similar to what they're doing now. You know, I mean, terrorism hasn't changed for 40 years.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about in places like Israel and...
Mm-hmm. Israel or even those... planes flying to the World Trade Center,
mm-hmm.
they're, all that is just a repeat of kamikazes in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Not much different.
Suicide bombing?
Uh-huh. And they were, the Viet Cong, they were doing a lot of suicide bombing and driving trucks loaded with explosives into American military hotels.
Mm-hmm.
They were blowing up restaurants where Americans frequently eating.
Mm-hmm.
Terrorism doesn't change much.
Mm-hmm.
None of this stuff is really new. It's just new to the United States.
Mm-hmm. A lot of sappers were suicidal, weren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they just load up, like with a backpack of explosives, or they'd even use children and wrap them in some device and send them, because they knew American troops would, would talk to the children, and they put explosives right up the kids,
mm-hmm.
blowing them up. And I never have really understood why the media has never talked about it very much. I mean, they always talk about My Lai, which was a terrible thing, but you never hear them talk about all the atrocities that the Vietnamese committed. I mean, they were really vicious.
Mm-hmm.
Osama bin Laden got nothing on those guys.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what did you think as far as the United States mission? What were we trying to accomplish there?
Oh, I think I thought at that time, and I think it's not much different. I don't think it's different now. I think they were trying to keep the communists from taking the country over and gaining a stronghold, because once they always said that the U.S. government always said that once Vietnam falls, all the rest fall. And that's what happened. I mean, you know, what they said would happen, happened, and it's even worse. I mean, they imprisoned I thought, if any mistake, well, I thought the way we ran the war was wrong. But as far as being that, I don't think that we were wrong in being that, trying to help those people.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back later to ask you what you mean by mistakes,
mm-hmm.
but I don't want to go into that issue yet.
Okay.
But I do want to discuss it later. And as far as the other earlier experiences, when you arrived in country, did you receive any additional training?
No. Okay. Nothing other than briefings, you know, on what was going on in intelligence type.
Okay. Did you work on your language at all?
Not really, informally maybe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I worked with the, you know, I had a counterpart with the 924th support group that I worked on. In fact, I worked with the guy just like my whole time there. Amazing. He showed up everywhere where I was.
And were there many Vietnamese counterparts or Vietnamese personnel in Smiat working alongside you, you were also advising, anything like that?
Yeah. Yeah, we were all stationed in the same compound.
Okay.
I mean, actually, I think it was the 924 support compound. They just gave us a building there. We just had an office there.
Okay.
Had a couple of offices and I think they supplied us with secretarial support.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they, you know, we just worked with them. You know, we had our own independent deals going on, but and I'm sure that we spied on them as much as they spied on us. I mean, in the intelligence community, the key is to never trust even your allies.
Yeah. So the 924th, the Arvin unit,
mm-hmm.
you were all there in the same location, sharing the same facilities, constantly interacting.
Right.
Okay. Was there any significant or serious suspicion that any of the personnel on the Arvin side were not who they claimed to be?
Not in the intelligence group. I don't think we had that problem.
Okay.
We didn't have any. I don't think that we had any VC plants within the 9 points. They were a pretty tight unit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those guys were, I was always very impressed with their capabilities. I mean, they took a lot of risks. I mean, they did the real serious, a lot of field intelligence. I mean, they sent in undercover guys into VC units. I mean, they did some really hairy stuff.
Yeah. Did they send guys in? They did send guys into North Vietnam?
Uh-huh, yeah. There was one program that was, that they recently read about where they were dropping them in.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a CIA program.
Mm-hmm.
And, they didn't do that. They weren't involved in that part of it. They did other things. You know, they would get hooked up. They did join North Vietnamese, army units or VC units and stuff to get up there like that. They didn't profit them.
Okay.
They didn't operate that way.
Okay.
In fact, the guy that wrote the book about that, he was in that unit. Wick Torreson.
Okay.
He was an interrogator with the, he's written a couple of books.
What's his name again?
Wick Torreson.
Okay.
He wrote a book on, talking with Victor Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
And, he was an interrogator. That was his actual job, as an interrogator. And he's written a couple of books. He wrote one on that, and then he wrote one on that CIA program where they were dropping them in.
Mm-hmm.
Behind enemy lines or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was kind of a dumb program.
Well, later on, especially near the end of the war, I guess, while we're in the discussion of crossed agents or plants, later, of course, it was recognized that the Viet Cong and even the NVA had even infiltrated the very highest echelons of the Arvin command structure. Were there later revelations that that had permeated, that infiltration had permeated even military intelligence for Arvin? That you know of?
I never heard that.
Okay.
You know, of course, you know, you don't hear that kind of, once you get out of a unit,
yeah.
Military intelligence is pretty tight-lipped.
Yeah.
But I'd say it's possible because, mm-hmm. It's, you know, as you grow, you know, and I'm sure they grew just like we did,
mm-hmm.
Into larger units, then, you know, you run that risk.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was so much, I know that even back then the government was so infiltrated with Viet Cong. I mean, we knew a lot of them and used them,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, either for giving misinformation to, and that kind of thing. But
yeah.
There were so many relatives. I mean, a guy in the South had a brother in the North. I mean, you know, all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there were a lot of, government was infiltrated. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we infiltrated theirs too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's just part of business.
Yeah. What kind of, were there any restrictions put on you in terms of, you know, personal activities? You as an American working there in Vietnam?
No, not really.
Okay.
We carried civilian identification. We didn't carry military ID. We had documents. So we weren't really out of military control.
Mm-hmm. Were there, that you're aware of, were there any attempts to turn Americans?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They tried to kidnap one of our agents once up in Bondi Hood. And, then one time, the same guy, this guy was unbelievable. He had quite an amazing tour. He'd been kidnapped. They tried to kidnap him.
Mm-hmm.
And then, he went on R&R to Bangkok, and while he was in Bangkok, he was playing tennis at some French club or something in Bangkok, and, he met these two guys, they were going out, you know, I guess they had drinks and dinner together and stuff like that, and as it turned out, they were KGB agents trying to recruit him.
Oh, for crying out loud.
They didn't even know who he was, they just thought he was an American soldier, you know.
Uh-huh.
And, they didn't know he was an intelligence. And he said all of a sudden he started understanding. He started recognizing the questions.
Oh, that's funny.
He turned them in. They set up an operation over there.
Uh-huh.
And, anyway, they were, expelled from, Bangkok. They were diplomats.
Uh-huh. Well, they used that cover for all their
intelligence people. Yeah, military attaché.
Sure. Okay.
So they got expelled.
Yeah. Any other?
Yeah, we had, yeah, you know, we had a lot of reports, we had different reports on things like that where they tried to turn. But I think early in the war, when I was there,
mm-hmm.
I don't think there was as much of that going on as it was later.
Okay.
I think you had a different brand of soldier
mm-hmm.
that came in the later part of the war.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you really talk, you know, when I look at, I've got a sister who's 7 years younger than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, people who were in the war in my class, well, people in her class went to war, you know, to the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, and I mean, her generation, I guess we're in the same sort of generation, but the people that were in her class were a lot different people than were in my class. You know, I think that they, the people who were in my age and went over at that time were a lot more maybe conservative than people who went later. That's what my opinion was. They just seemed like different type of soldiers. The guys that went over there initially were more committed to the cause, I think, than the guys later.
Mm-hmm. Well, as far as other personnel, and specifically intelligence personnel, were there CIA liaisons there that worked with you?
Yeah, we worked pretty close with them.
Yeah. Well, how would you describe the relationship between U.S. Army Military Intelligence and the Central Intelligence Agency at that time?
I think it was good. I mean, we had a good, on an agent-to-agent relationship,
mm-hmm.
I think it was good,
mm-hmm.
you know. We used a lot of their resources. You know, sometimes they
we'd find agents and we'd share them and do things like that. But that was on a you know, a local level. What happened higher up, I don't know. I don't know how they, on an upper echelon level, I don't know how they got along.
Yeah.
But I know on an agent-to-agent level, yeah, we did a lot of joint things together, passed information back, but it was informal. There was nothing formal.
Okay. Were you ever given instructions not to do that?
Mm-hmm. You know, got instructions about anything.
Okay.
Just didn't be able to deny it. That's all.
Okay.
I mean, the lack of instructions was pretty evident at the time. I didn't think much about it, but
yeah.
When I look back on it now, here I was a kid, 18, 19 years old, out there running all kinds of operations. That was pretty brazen on their part.
Yeah. Well, when you mentioned repeatedly now this idea of plausible deniability, were there specific things or specific ways you would structure your operations for that purpose?
Well, we were documented. I mean, we all had covers.
Mm-hmm.
We all used different names. We all had different cover stories for wherever we were. I don't know how many different cover stories, different parts of the country, different names, identifications, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, pretty much, you know, I mean, we did things. We went cross border long before anybody else ever did. And, I mean, we were in Laos, Cambodia, we went all of those places. And, you know, the State Department were just flipping out. But but they never knew when we went over or what we did or anything else. And you know, the government or the military just denied.
Mm-hmm.
They're not military guys. We don't know who the hell they are.
Okay.
Even the military didn't know who we were.
Well, what was going on? What kind of... What kinds of missions and operations were being conducted in Laos and Cambodia?
I used to go over to, there was a unit, a Royal Laotian unit that was just across the border from Vietnam to Laos. I used to, team, I was on a two-man team when I was in Kaesong.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go over to this 33, but it was a Royal Laotian battalion that was stationed there on Highway 9. Inside of the Laotian border, we would use the door there all the time. And, you know, gather intelligence, get information, get sources over there. And we'd take, you know, food, rice, money, whatever, buy it, get them to do stuff for us, whatever we did.
Okay. Now, you were in Saigon from November 65 to April 66.
Mm-hmm.
Then went to Dalat from April 66 to September 66, and then Kaesong.
Right.
From September 66 to June 67.
Right.
Were there any other, specific events, operations, reports, or anything like that that you recall from your time at Saigon that you'd like to discuss?
Can't think of any. I know that, while I was there, I did some operations, with the French. Well, not with the French, but where the French were involved,
mm-hmm.
And with the Vietnam, and I know we did.
This is Saigon, or
Saigon.
Okay.
Some of the guys, like the, you know, the French owned a beer company there, and they owned a lot of restaurants,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of thing. And they were doing a lot of. We had some French who were we used as sources of information who had contacts with the Vietcong.
So when you say you ran operations that involved them, they were the source of the information. They weren't. It wasn't French military or French intelligence involved in the operation.
I never had any contact much with French intelligence. They were over there. Probably some of these guys might have been. I don't know.
Okay. Any other foreign nationals that were involved in these types of operations besides the French?
Mm-hmm. Italians. There was a couple of Italians there. We had one that owned a plantation on the side of us that, that we used as a He had a lot of BG that frequented his, he had a rubber plantation.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you went from Saigon to Da Lat and taught English there at the university, of course, there's also the military academy, the Vietnamese National Military Academy. Was that active while you were there?
I don't recall it.
Okay.
Could have been there, but
yeah.
I don't remember.
Okay.
I didn't have any connection with it.
What was your primary mission in terms of your intelligence mission while you were in Da Lat?
When I was there, the main reason I was there was we were training some civilian agents from they were Montagnards from Quezon area,
uh-huh.
And we were doing some training there, agent training for them, and that was what I was in. And they had an office there that was doing regular intelligence gathering. But I was there, and the guy who I was replacing, Quezon, was there. He had they had pulled him down, and we were just going over operations. So it was pretty cool.
Okay. When you say training, what did that involve?
Well, we were training these guys to use some electronic devices.
Uh-huh.
We were training them about how to gain information from soldiers, North Vietnamese soldiers, how to identify different types of vehicles.
When you say electronics,
how to be spies.
Okay. Yeah. When you say electronics, you mean motion sensing devices, eavesdropping? What kind of?
We had some motion detection devices
uh-huh.
that they were using. They were put inside of bamboo,
uh-huh.
And then they were radio transmitters, and they didn't work very well. I didn't think they were very good.
Uh-huh.
Although they did use them later as something else, civilian use in the United States. But they put these devices in there, and then somebody passed through, like soldiers passed through a path. It would transmit
uh-huh.
like an alarm.
Mm-hmm.
And then but animals and all kinds of crap.
People
just walking down the path,
yeah.
You know, would set them off. It was very difficult to operate. Then they, we had radio transmitters where they could transmit some kind of crude form of Morse code. That.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How well did they take to that training?
Very well. It was good.
Were there Vietnamese involved with this as well, or was it just Montagnards?
Just Montagnards.
And these were Montagnards who then went back to the Quezon area?
Uh-huh.
To gather intelligence? And,
right.
Okay. Was there a, do you know if there was a specific name for this operation?
Could
the training?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I can't remember.
Okay. Hmm. Well, did you ever train other, groups either within Vietnam or maybe Laotians or Cambodians to conduct
not
similar
really,
tests?
Not formally.
Not formally? And well, later you were at Quezon.
Right.
Did you get to see any of these Montagnards that you had trained? And
oh yeah, we were used.
Okay.
They were our agents.
Okay, so you spent the time in Da Lat training, and then when they were finished, you went with them back
right.
to that area.
Uh huh.
Oh, okay. So let's see. So was it? For them, was the training from April to September as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's the right date. I'm not 100% sure on the date. I mean, it's been a long time.
Yes, sir.
A hard time. I don't know why, but I have a hard time remembering the months, you know.
Well,
you know, a few of them I remember, but I just can't remember exactly when I was there.
Understand. Well, so what was the... in Da Lat, what was the atmosphere like as far as for Americans? Were they pretty?
It was great. I didn't want to leave.
Okay.
Man, what a wonderful place it was at that time. They had like a big lake there. You could rent paddle boats. Downtown was like a little French cafe.
Uh-huh.
You could set up on the sidewalk and, you know, have coffee or wine or a little something to eat. They had, you know, you could go into the, they had a big park there with waterfalls. Oh, it's beautiful. And nothing was going on around there at that time. I mean, as far as combat, there were hardly any soldiers there. I didn't see any American soldiers there at all.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe just a few, but hardly any. And not many Vietnamese soldiers. It was a pretty neutral territory. Everybody used to say that the VC and the U.S. were using it as a R&R area. I didn't see many Americans there on R&R, but it just wasn't much going on in that area. I think that's why they picked it as a place to do some training.
Okay. And how effective do you think the training was?
It was okay. It was good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it worked. These people are, I mean, they're pretty primitive. So one of the things, problems that we ran into, at least I was told, I didn't have this problem too much. But the guy who I was replacing you send out the lawn yards, and he'd say, yeah, I saw a truck. And they'd say, well, what kind of truck? Y'all, biggest truck I've ever seen. Then you find out the guy never saw a truck before. So it could have been a Jeep, you know. I mean, they had nothing to compare it with. So they needed some orientation as to what military equipment looked like, and, you know, what they were actually seeing, you know, so that they could explain it. And one of the missions that we did was that we identified tanks over there long before they came across the border and overran the Special Forces camp.
Mm-hmm.
We informed them months before it happened that they were there, and nobody believed it.
Okay. Well, how would you communicate with the Muslims?
In person. I mean, we'd go meet them. We'd have an area to meet them.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd meet and somewhere in the jungle someplace. And that was the most probably dangerous part of the job. Because
mm-hmm.
you didn't know if the guy was set up, if he'd been captured. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, the North Vietnamese knew what we did. And they'd love to catch an intelligence agent, you know, drag it back to North Vietnam.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, they knew we were there. Because there's only two of us in the village here.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't at the time that day.
This is when you were in Quezon.
Uh huh.
What about the language barrier?
We had interpreters for the Montagnards because they, you know, so many people speak Montagnard.
Right.
And,
were these Vietnamese interpreters?
No, Montagnard.
Oh. Okay.
We had a Montagnard guy who, he could speak Vietnamese and Montagnard. And my partner, Ed, is me, so we were going through about a 3 or 4 way interpretation.
Yeah.
So sometimes we had to go slow, but this guy was good. He was a good, assistant. You know, he'd go with us anyway.
Okay. And, let's see. Is there anything else that you'd like to discuss about your time in the lot?
No, I can't think of anything. It was nice. Living conditions were great. We had a nice big villa there we lived in. I don't know what kind of operations they were running at.
Uh-huh.
I didn't pay much attention to what they were doing. I just know they had a nice place to live.
Right.
You know, it was a very, very nice place.
Okay.
The town was great. They had that big, nuclear power plant there. It was right in the lot. And it was just, you know, just like a resort area. I remember it was cool there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
Well, when you left the lot, went to Quezon, what was that area like? Quezon, in comparison.
It was like, you walked into hell. I mean, the place was, mud, red mud up to your rear end. And, I mean, it was nasty. Just the terrible living conditions. We, when I first went up there, of course you landed at the, Marine base there. And then we drove in to the village where our bunker where we lived was in inside of the district headquarters. They had like a little fort there, Hunghwa District Headquarters, which was the headquarters for the for that area, that province, whatever they call it. And, you know, it was fenced, and they had this civilian force there defending it. Not much of a force, but they had a, you know, bunch of Vietnamese. And there were some Vietnamese and some Montagnards who were stationed at that place. No Americans, just us.
Did you have much interaction with the Marines?
Yeah. We had, they had a couple of, Marine intelligence officers there. I'm not sure exactly how they operate. They didn't operate like we did. They were basically collect information from the recon units and, from us.
Mm-hmm.
We give them information and, you know, they just coordinate. They were more like intelligence coordinators, I think.
Okay.
But we communicate with them a lot. And then sometimes we'd go with the, Marines if they, if we wanted to had some information about something specific we wanted to verify, we might go with the, Marine Recon Group or something on patrol or something at night to see if we could verify something we were looking for.
What was the atmosphere in Khe Sanh City? Or the village?
very primitive. I mean, it's just a very primitive place. It's mixed. They have some Vietnamese live there, some Montagnards live there. There were some Americans, civilians who lived there. There was a couple. I think his name was Miller or something. Him and his wife were translating the Bible into Montagnard or something like that. I don't know. They were doing something. They were like missionaries. And, they were up there. And then there were two women missionaries, who had a little compound there. They built a church and they had a little grass hut that they lived in. One was a nurse. Maybe both of them were nurses. And they were doing missionary work. There was a French Catholic priest, I think, up there. I think he was French. And he was doing some kind of missionary work. Then there was a Frenchman, who ran a coffee plantation up there. And him and his wife and family, lived there. And we used him. He was a good source of information. And he later got killed and during the siege, I think, in Khe Sanh, he was killed. And then there was a guy there. He had a coffee plantation there also. Very shady guy. Did a lot of work. He did a lot of dealings with the North Vietnamese. And he was just very kind of a sleazy guy, and he disappeared. I don't know whatever happened. He vanished. Nobody ever knew whatever happened. Probably he went back to the North Vietnamese or something. I'm not sure.
Uh-huh.
But he had been there. There was a guy who, going back in a little history there, there was a guy, the Frenchman who was there, his father had started that coffee plantation. And he was killed in the 50s, I think it was in the 50s, by the communists. The communists, maybe it was the, what did they call them before? I forget now. Before they were Viet Minh.
Yes, sir.
The, Viet Minh had stopped him at a roadblock and on Highway 9 and they executed him. And, his son stayed there and, was running the coffee plantation. Then he was killed, I think, at the Marine base or something. I'm not sure. I know he was later killed, and his family moved back to France. And the other guy, who was kind of the
sleazy guy. There was a man by the name of Rome who had a Japanese wife, and they had been spies for the Japanese in World War II, and they were spying on the French. And at the end of World War II, they were mysteriously killed. And then this guy, and I can't think of his name right now, took over his plantation. He just showed up. Of course, you know, there they didn't have any deed of trust to whoever owned, who's ever occupying the land it belongs to, I guess. And he just all of a sudden shows up, and they think, suspected him, our intelligence information was that he killed them.
Mm-hmm.
And then he took over their plantation, and he was suspected in a couple of murders of Montagnards.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pretty strongly suspected that he was involved in killing the Frenchman's father, because he was with him at the time they got stopped at the roadblock, and nothing happened to him, but the other guy was executed.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he was a real smart, but we used him as a source of information, but he was not a cooperative sort. He was only doing it because we forced him to, because we threatened to turn him into the South Vietnamese and let them take him prisoner and provide the evidence that he was cooperating with the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So he agreed to cooperate with us. So we used him as a source of information.
Okay.
But then there were numerous Montagnard villages scattered around Quezon, little villages, and they very interesting areas. We'd go out a lot of times with the special forces. They did these medic recons, what they call medical recons, where the medic and two or three guys, we'd all go out to these outlying villages, give them medical assistance, you know, perform the medic with, you know, if somebody was sick, give them some kind of help or something. It was kind of a helping, you know,
mm-hmm.
to get people to like it. And we'd go and collect intelligence information while they were doing that. We'd just go with them. And, but some of those villages were really interesting. They operated, I think, you know, some of the villages had chiefs. Chief would have six or seven wives. it was really interesting culture, actually. I mean, the way it appeared to me was that the Montagnards, they would save up on, I don't know exactly what they're bartering, food, I guess, things like that were their bartering tools, but they didn't have money. But they, when they got enough property or whatever, they would purchase a wife, and then once they got a wife, they retired. And the wife went out in the fields and did all the work. And they'd sit around in their little grass huts and drink tea all day. They'd have a little fire going inside. I always wondered what kept those huts from burning down.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have an open fire. The floor, the roof, everything was like bamboo or some kind of maybe it was elephant grass or something, but it was a weaved house. And, I guess they had something on top of it, but they'd have an open fire right in the middle of the thing. They'd sit around in there and drink tea. We'd go in and talk to them for hours. You know, they'd tell you anything you want to know. They had feet. They didn't wear shoes. I mean, none of them. Even when, we'd get them in uniforms, they didn't want shoes, and you couldn't get shoes that were big enough for them because their feet were so wide from being barefoot, walking barefoot so long, and they were like leather at the bottoms of their feet.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you couldn't even find boots to fit them because they were like probably triple X wide or something.
Interesting.
Yeah. Huge feet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, wide. Not long, but wide.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they'd wear the uniform and barefoot. But their feet were like shoes, you know. I mean, they'd walk barefoot so long, they just tough on the bottom of their feet.
Yeah, they could go anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't affect them.
Didn't bother them at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they probably had such tough skin on the bottom of their feet, they didn't even feel anything.
Mm-hmm.
Just like a lot of the ones that we dealt with had, fought against the Viet Minh with the French.
Mm-hmm.
And, they hated the communists.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, I mean, they just had a hate for him. just they were very loyal people. The Montagnards. I was very fond of them.
Do you remember receiving any specific or particularly helpful intelligence from Montagnards that were not part of your network? I mean, just going in with the village chief.
Mm-hmm.
Anything stand out in your mind?
Well, troop movements. Usually we'd always get troop movements because troops would come into their villages at night. And a lot of times they'd give us information on, where they were storing arms or rice or something like that. And, cause they had to pay, you know, they had to pay the VC to, you know, to give them, they would come in and tax them. You know, so much rice or whatever they had. They had to pay it to the VC to keep from the villages from being burned down. So they'd come in and kill them all if they didn't pay the tax. They'd call it a tax. And, anytime we went, they always, because we had sort of a relationship with all the chiefs around there. And, you know, we knew their situation. They didn't have any choice about the matter. They had to cooperate with the VC. And, we would, you know, we always brought gifts, rice, whatever. Give it to them. And, they were tobacco. That's what they liked a lot. They smoked pipes, some of them. They liked pipe tobacco. But they always gave us pretty, I think pretty reliable intelligence. So mainly, units, we trained them on how to find out what unit they were with, especially the North Vietnamese. And, so that they could tell us which units were in the area.
Was that by insignia?
I think most, some of the time, I don't think it was so much by insignia. Seems like, I think they got it actually from the soldiers.
Okay.
I don't remember whether they wore insignia or not. I don't recall now. I don't think they did. But I remember they'd find it from the, soldiers, because they'd come in and he'd give them tea. We'd teach them to, you know, butter them up, bring them in, let them come. Especially the North Vietnamese. We were mostly interested in North Vietnamese.
Well, in these smaller Montagnard villages, were there young men, or were they taken away, conscripted into the Viet Cong ranks or the North Vietnamese ranks?
I don't think they were, you know, I think there were young men there. I don't think they used them, because I don't think they trusted them, for one thing. And the other thing is, I think there was a real racial problem between Vietnamese and Montagnards. Yeah, I mean, and that included the South Vietnamese. They thought that they were stupid, they didn't like them, and they just, I don't know, they didn't, they, and I don't think that, I think the North Vietnamese had the same opinions of them. They just used them to get stuff, and they didn't care, but I don't think they used them in their army. Because they didn't fit in, I don't think they would have fit in with them. Maybe the VC, but mostly up there you run into mostly North Vietnamese troops.
Okay.
But now, I don't remember. I mean, maybe they did some, but I don't recall hearing that much. I just think that there was a big racial thing between the two races, the Vietnamese and the Montagnards. And they considered the Montagnards just, and they were very, very primitive. I mean, they were extremely primitive people.
Yeah.
Their language wasn't even written. It wasn't a written language.
Your Montagnard operatives, the ones that you trained, the ones that you interacted with, that were out in the field gathering intelligence for you, how frequently would you have contact with them?
Well, sometimes it depends on what we were sending them to do. Sometimes we'd send them way in, maybe way up in the Laos or up that way. They might be gone for a couple of weeks. Then they'd come back. We'd find out they were back, and we go talk to them, debrief them, what they've seen. But, I mean, usually, it varied, depending on, some of them were local, you know, just went out, chopped wood locally. Most, a lot of wood choppers. We always had wood choppers in and they'd be chopping wood because that was a normal thing that they would see soldiers, you know, would see people doing, chopping wood for the village.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes they, you know, we'd hear from them. A lot of times they'd send kids. If they were in a remote village, they'd send a kid down to us and say, hey, so-and-so's back. He wants to talk to you. So then we'd cruise on up wherever they were.
Okay.
Debrief. Sometimes they'd just come into the village, but we discouraged that because of too many VC spies and North Vietnamese spies in the village.
Okay.
We'd rather meet them somewhere else.
Did you ever run into any Soviets in Quezon area?
We ran into information about them.
No, into Soviet operatives.
Oh, no. No, we got information about Soviets over in Laos, but that was as close as I heard of any of them around.
What did you get on about Soviets in Laos?
There was a big what they call the it was like an R&R center, and I think they used it as a POW stop and taking prisoners north in Laos that. We had heard on a number of occasions that Soviet KGB agents were over there interrogating American POWs. And I don't know if they did it directly. I don't think they interrogated them directly, but I think they directed the Vietnamese interrogators. I don't think they wanted to be seen by the American POWs in case one of them escaped or something.
Okay.
They didn't want a direct connection, but I think that they observed the interrogations, and they also exchanged information with the North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
I think they did a lot of direction over there.
Okay. Now, and after you would debrief your Montagnard sources, what would you do with that intelligence?
We'd write up a report, send it back to our regional headquarters.
Where was that?
Way.
Okay. And what would they do with it?
Send it back to the headquarters. They'd have somebody there type it up.
Uh-huh.
Because what we did, we didn't even have a typewriter. We'd handwrite it and then give it to a crypto operator in Quezon, and then he'd transmit it back to Way.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think we had clerical people there. I think they'd type it up in the IR format, intelligence report format, and then transmit it to Saigon.
Okay.
I mean, that's the way I think it happened. I'm not 100% sure, but because I wasn't involved in that. I just got the raw stuff and sent it in.
Right.
And then sometimes we used, if it was timely information, I had a counterpart up there that he wasn't there all the time, but he was there a lot, and with the 924th, and I'd give him the report, and they had a radio transmitter, one of those old World War II generators where the guy'd sit there and pump it, and then he would send the intelligence information back by some kind of radio transmission. It was a code, like Morse code, but it was they'd send that back through their channels, and then they'd give it to our Way headquarters. Sometimes, occasionally we did it that way. I don't remember. But in fact, I remember that when we got the information on the tanks, the Soviet tanks over there, we sent it that way back to try to get it back quickly. And then I didn't always directly give information to the Marines, because when you have raw intelligence, sometimes raw intelligence is not very... It's not very useful to a combat unit, but we thought that this was pretty important, so we told the Marine commander and the Special Forces commander about it.
And this is about the tanks. Was there any other what you thought was vital or timely intelligence that was important for the U.S. commanders to know about?
Sometimes if we had a large troop movement, we'd notify them.
Okay.
You know, a large unit of North Vietnamese moving somewhere. Sometimes we'd give them information directly. We gave a lot of information to Special Forces because they understood that, you know, what raw intelligence was, because they did a lot of it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So they, I mean, you know, we could give it to them, and they understood what we were giving them. You know, not the Marines. I think commanders sometimes had a hard time. They didn't understand how intelligence worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they, you know, they didn't know what to do with the information, or they didn't believe it. Mostly, as I recall.
Okay.
I mean, how do you know that? You know, and things like that. And
mm-hmm.
I say, well, you know, that's for me to know.
Mm-hmm.
How I know it, but I can tell you that it's reliable.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, they didn't believe it. They wouldn't even let me go in. It got to be where they wouldn't let me into the Marine war room down there. They had a war room underground, and I'd usually go in there. That's where the commander a lot of times was.
And yeah.
Give him information. They wouldn't let me come in there.
Why?
Well, they were afraid I was going to get captured, and then I could give them information about what I saw in there. But I tell you the truth, I didn't know what the heck they had up. I mean, I didn't pay any attention to what they had up in there. But.
Uh-huh. Okay.
The colonel was worried about it, so.
Huh.
He, you know, they didn't, we weren't military. You know what I mean?
Yes,
I mean,
sir.
It's, we weren't in military uniforms. We were in mixed uniforms. You know, we were kind of like these part of the special operations kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't like that.
Yeah.
I mean, they just, they couldn't. I don't know. They just couldn't adapt to it,
yeah.
Some of the military commanders. So they just thought that it was, you know, we were just a bunch of cowboys that, you know, running around,
mm-hmm.
I guess. I don't know.
Did you ever do much work with SOG?
Yeah, we did quite a bit. They were right down the street from us, if you want to call it street. Yeah, they were at the French Fort there in Quezon.
Mm.
And we used to... stay with them at one time, and then we moved into the home office to get our own place. And all. It was a little more secure as far as keeping stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they were running. They were fairly young then, you
mm-hmm.
know, early missions at that time. I think they did a lot more later.
Did they? Was there much sharing of information between you, your team, and SOG?
Yeah, we'd give them all. We give them whatever we had, especially if we had anything on troop movements, you know, because, you know, if they were going to go into some area, get dropped into some area in Laos, they were pretty interested if we had any information, you know, about troop movements in that specific area.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that you also made some trips into Laos yourself. What were the nature of those trips?
We'd go over to, mostly with the trips that we made there were to that, Royal Laotian Battalion,
uh-huh.
Battalion 33, I think. That keeps sticking in my head. I think that was the name of it.
Okay.
Battalion 33. They were, friendly Laotian troops.
Mm-hmm.
And, so they, we would go over there, get information. At one time we drove over there but generally, we got a helicopter. We'd commandeer a helicopter to take us over there.
Okay.
You know, like mostly a SOG helicopter,
because mm-hmm.
most of those were unmarked.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd get them to drop us in and then tell them come back pick us up that afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Then we'd talk to the commander over there and a different one, get information. A lot of those guys were on dope over there. I don't know why the North Vietnamese allowed them to survive as long as they did.
What do you mean?
Well, they were out there in the middle of nowhere. They were out there by themselves. There were the North Vietnamese who had regiment-sized units coming by there, and they could have wiped them out any time they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
There was no reason to form to even allow them to exist.
Mm.
But they just didn't bother them for some reason.
Okay.
I mean, I guess they would fight, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the end... they came back. In fact, they were the ones that showed up at the Special Forces camp during the siege in 68.
Mm-hmm.
They showed up over at the Special Forces camp. And some of those guys were traitors, too. I mean, some of them were North Vietnamese plants. I think it's probably why they allowed them to exist.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When you went into Laos, did you have contact with any of the other American personnel working in that country?
No.
Okay.
No, we weren't even supposed to be there.
Right. Okay. Well, let's see. You mentioned in the questionnaire that you had a brief trip to Hue in 1966.
Yes, I'd been in Hue. Yeah.
It says TDY Hue.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, that's where our regional headquarters was.
Okay.
At Hue. So I used to go back there occasionally, you know, back to our headquarters from
right.
Kathon.
Okay.
That's a pretty city. It was. I don't know about it anymore. But
mm-hmm.
It was pretty at that time. That was before 68.
Okay. Good enough. This is Steve Maxer continuing the interview with Mr. Jim Turner on CD number 2, conducting the interview on 5 December 2001. Sir, what was communication like for you back to the States, to your family, you know, as far as correspondence, telephone calls, things like that?
Where I was stationed, it was only letters. Could send. We had free mail at that time, and you could send letters back and forth, but I didn't have any telephonic communication or radio or anything like that.
How frequently would you hear from your family?
I usually hear from, well, the mail was, when I was in the lot in Saigon, I got my mail fairly regularly, but in when I was in Quezon, I'd say I'd get mail once a week. They'd bring it in, and that was if it was good weather. If it wasn't good weather, it may be delayed longer, because my mail would have to come up through my regional headquarters in Hue, and then they'd send it up on some aircraft coming up to Quezon. Then I'd have to go down and get it either from the Special Forces camp or the Marine base, one of the two.
Now, you mentioned that you didn't have telephone or radio contact. Did you have any form of entertainment at all? You know, radios, where you could listen to radio stations?
It was just the two of us up there. We had bought at the PX one time, we bought this record player that was operated by batteries and played 33 and a third records. And that was our entertainment.
Okay.
That was all we had.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, pretty much the way we lived, I think we lived a lot differently up there because we were so remote. We had few conveniences. We didn't have any running water. If we weren't going out on a patrol at night, we pretty much went to bed when it got dark, got up when it was day, when the sun came up.
Okay.
And we didn't have any electricity or generators or anything like that. We just had candles. So we pretty much lived fairly primitively up there. No showers. Had to wash out of a helmet or a bucket or something.
Mm. How frequently would you be visited by supervisors?
Never. They never came up there.
Okay.
They just didn't want to make that trip. It was so remote that most of the time we were more than glad to go back to our regional headquarters where we could get showers and decent food.
Mm-hmm.
We were living off of sea rations and whatever we could get locally. And you know, back there you could get a shower, you could go out and get a drink of beer or something.
Mm-hmm.
You had some entertainment there in Hue.
Mm-hmm. Well, while you were stationed there at Quezon, what was your official unit of assignment?
Well, I was in two different units. Actually, I was with the, when I initially went up there, I was at Company C of the 519th. And then I was, and I'm not sure the date of this, but I was then reassigned to the 149th Military Intelligence Group. Same job, they just changed the designation, and we were known as the Joint Technical Advisory Detachment.
Okay. Let's see. And as far as your daily activities, would you interact a lot with Vietnamese civilians? Did you have a lot of interaction just with people generally?
Oh, yeah. Just everybody that lived around it. I mean, we were part of the community there in Quezon Village. We knew all the people there. They knew us. And, you know, in the beginning, we went up there undercover as a, what did they call it? Geographical survey group or something. Anyway, we were supposedly drawing maps up there. But, I mean, in a small town like that, you cover it doesn't last very long. They realized what we were up there for. They didn't know who we were, but they knew we were some kind of an intelligence outfit. In fact, a book that was written about Quezon, the guy who was the chaplain in Quezon, a Marine Navy chaplain in Quezon, he wrote a book about Quezon, and he mentioned the our unit, and he thought we were part of the CIA. And I've talked to him since a couple of times that we're in the same association. I belong to the Quezon Veterans Association.
Okay.
And we've talked, you know, about it. I told him some of the history behind the units up there. They had been up the, starting with SMEOT, they'd had people up in that area for many years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And let's see. Were there any particular operations that stand out in your mind? And when you went out, did you ever make enemy contact?
We on a couple of occasions we went out. I know we had a Montagnard group that would go out on patrols at night in the Quezon area, and we'd go out with them on some occasions, and I know on one occasion we were set up in this valley, this sort of a hillside in the path of the trail that went up down through the valley. We were set up in the jungle on both sides of that thing, and we were up there one night, and I'd say we were within 20 yards of a battalion-sized unit. They came walking past. They never knew we were there, but we watched them go by. We were close enough to reach out and grab some of them sometimes. But we just were there for intelligence. We weren't there to engage them in combat. And we had on occasion I think some specific incidents. I know one time we were coming down Highway 9. We had a three-quarter ton army truck that was painted gray. And we were coming, kind of a bluish gray. And we were coming down Highway 9, my partner Ed and I. And we came around a corner, and it was like a VC roadblock. I think it looked like to me it was only five of them or so. It wasn't very many of them. But we were going so fast that we ran right through them before they realized what had happened. And, I mean, they started shooting at us, but we were really going by the time they realized who we were. But we just kept on hatting up with the truck, got on down the highway. We just said, hey, I think that was VC. But, today I think... knowing what I know today, I don't think I would have taken all the chances that we did back then, but we used to just go everywhere. I mean, we'd go out in the jungle, just two or three of us, you know, and actually I think that was probably safer because it was harder to detect us. And, we'd go out to these outlying villages and visit these village chiefs and things like that. I mean, it was really fairly dangerous. And we did on a couple occasions get in some shooting at each other from some distance. Usually we never were real close contact. Our job was to escape and evade, and that's what we did mostly. We weren't there to engage the enemy. We were there to observe the enemy.
Were there any Viet Cong that would come into Quezon Village?
Oh, yeah, there was some. We knew the police chief, the district police chief. He was a he was a North Vietnamese spy, and we knew it. I mean, we used him a lot. You know, we'd given him misinformation and that kind of thing. But he, I mean, there were, I'm sure that there were BC that came right into the village. They just, you know, they had probably had family there and everything else.
How could a North Vietnamese become a police chief of a major village in a province?
Well, you know, the government of South Vietnam was, whenever you have a lot of poverty, and there was a lot of, there's a lot of poverty in that country, even, I guess, today, I think even today is probably a lot of poverty. But then a policeman made $20 a month. And even back then, that wasn't very much money. And I mean, as an American sergeant up there, I was making $500 a month with all the different add-ons. And, I mean, if $20 a month, and the difference between $20 a month and $500 a month, that's a lot of difference. And whenever you got that much poverty, and so it's easy to buy people. I mean, it's easy to, and then they have, a lot of them have mixed, you know, a lot of people didn't like the Americans. I mean, we came in and took the country over. I mean, that, Vietnam, when I left there, Vietnam reminded me of just one big army base. You know, we inflated the economy. I mean, for the average person there, I'm sure that it was not a real pleasant experience for them. I mean, they had all of these Americans there. They were, you know, and generally speaking, I think GIs, they don't, they had the same problem in London in World War II. You know, I mean, I think the Englishmen were getting a little tired of America and so many Americans there. You, like, take the whole country over. And I think their economy was based on the military spending.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, in black market, and I mean, just everything was. In people in the outlying villages, you know, if the Vietnamese, the VC, are bombing them on one side, and the Americans and the VC were bombing them on the other side. You know, I mean, they were just caught in, most of the people were caught in the middle, and the government so little, so affected their lives so little, I don't think they really cared who was in charge.
Yeah.
But I think they probably cared later, you know, when the communists took over. Some of them were pretty scared of the communists because they knew how they operated.
Well, what did you think about the Vietnamese people in general? And did your opinion of the Vietnamese change over time as you spent more time in the country?
I don't know. I guess it did, because I really had no opinion of them when I first got there. I didn't know anything about them, really. I made a lot of friends that were Vietnamese over there. I felt sorry for a lot of them. I mean, the way they had to live, there was a lot of corruption. But I mean, that's in any third world country. I think you find that, and you've got people who are extremely rich and extremely poor, and very little middle class. I like the South Vietnamese. I know a lot of people had didn't have very good opinions of their fighting ability, but they were involved in more combat than the Americans. They lost a heck of a lot more people than we did, that's for sure. And, you know, I mean, they were caught right in the middle of it, and it was, you know, I mean, they had relatives. Some of them had relatives in the North, and I think a lot of them had mixed feelings about, you know, what was going on there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think the Americans didn't have a real good image. I think compared to their economic situation, I think they saw most Americans as rich. Mm-hmm. Even the privates in the army,
yeah,
compared to them, were rich. that and everybody used to joke about the big PX is the United States, you know. And I mean, they came in, and I don't know how you control those kind of things when you have so many people. You just flood the economy. I don't know how you can control that, but that I mean, we just ruined their economy. Inflation was just really out of control there for those people. But I think most of them were just basically pretty decent people. You know, they have a different culture, and you know, they look at things differently. But when you're poor and you've been at war for a couple hundred years, you probably everybody look at it a little bit different.
Yeah. What did you think about the South Vietnamese political system?
Oh, I think it was pretty corrupt. I think it was pretty well manipulated. I mean, for a short period of time when I was in Saigon, they sent me over to do some negotiating. There were some Americans who had been arrested and put in prison in South Vietnam for civilian crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I went over to just to relieve this guy was going on leave or something. But he was going to be gone for a little while, so I was just like kind of filling in for the guy. And he was the guy who sort of coordinated getting them released or negotiating, getting the people out of jail or put into another jail in the United States, something like, I don't know, all kinds of different things. Well, the bureaucracy there was so terrible that if you were trying to get anything done through legal channels, I mean, you'd die of old age over there. So what a lot of times the guy told me, he says, well, here's what you tell the, because a lot of times the parents of the people would come over there or relatives and try to get them out of jail some kind of way because the jails weren't too good over there. And what he said is you're better off just pay off the jailers and get them out and then take them on out of there. So that's what they did most of the time. You just set up a deal where you just pay off the jailers and the guys go back to the States. They'd let them out of the prison.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's just, I think that generally because of the economic conditions, they just, you know, you could just about buy anything there. You could pay your way out of anything.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty corrupt. Now, I don't know about the upper levels. I guess the president, I think Win Khao Ky was pretty well thought of by people, and the guy that just died, the last president.
President Tu.
He was, I think he was a pretty honest guy he's just an impossible situation, but they, you know, they have so many layers of bureaucracy that, you know, you just have corruption all up and through it because of the money situation.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that you had some doubts about the American, I guess, strategy concerning the war. What did you think about how the United States was approaching the war in Vietnam, and what did you think was wrong?
Well, I've always thought, you know, you're always going to have politicians involved in decision-making of military matters. I mean, that's just the way our government works. But I think that they were trying, it was too much politics going on. And they were trying to fight a World War II type war in an unconventional warfare. I think if they had used the same techniques that they're using today in Afghanistan, I think we would have come up with the same result. But you've got to, they didn't attack the North. You know, they were fighting a defensive war, and you can't win a war like that. You can't win on the defensive. You know, they weren't going after the source of the problem, which was in Hanoi. They should have invaded the country, and there they ended the war. I mean, they could have been over, I think, in one-third of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't go into a war like that. I mean, just, you know, basically putting up security guards around the country, that just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Because you just become the target. And they tried to make it too much of a conventional war. I think if they had allowed the run a special operations, a special forces type war,
mm-hmm.
like they're doing in Afghanistan, they would have had the same results they're having today in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. That's the way you've got to fight terrorists like that. You can't fight them head on, because they just hit you and run. It's a hit and run all the time. And, you know, you just can't find them when you got 1,000 military guys marching through the jungle, and they, with all the support and everything else going on, I mean, you never find them. They just retreat. They just go hide somewhere else and watch you go by. And I just think they didn't have the information or the knowledge of how to fight that kind of war. I mean, the Ho Chi Minh had been fighting that kind of war for decades, and he knew how to fight it, and he knew that he could outlast them. And, you know, basically, we didn't lose any, militarily, we didn't lose any battles. We just quit. You know, I hear people say we lost the war. I don't think we lost the war. We just quit. We just said, forget it. We're out of here. You know, they were tired of the demonstrations back in the United States and all the different public outcries, I think, and they just said, we're tired of it. Let's get out of here. But I think that we could have, we could have whipped them, I think, fairly easy. I mean, the North Vietnamese were pretty good soldiers. They were fairly well trained and well equipped. They had good weapons and that kind of thing. But I don't think they were any competition for us. I mean, I think we could have gone in. If we had invaded Hanoi, I mean, I think we would have taken them out. They would have had to retreat to defend their own country. They wouldn't have kept invading in the South. But, you know, I don't know. I guess I think they just trying to. They were afraid of China, and I think they were afraid of Russia. And but I think that we, you know, I just think that it wasn't smart militarily the way they operated.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, you raise a very important consideration for the political consideration facing the Johnson administration. That was concern over escalating the war beyond the borders of Vietnam. You know, and to get the Korean analogy, if we get too close to China, they might become militarily involved. Were these things that you gave any kind of thought to at the time, or are you?
I think it's a possibility, and I think the possibility was because I think they made an error in Korea. I mean,
yeah.
They listened to MacArthur, and they should have bombed the heck out of the North Korean or the Chinese when they came across the border. I mean, I think there's always a chance of escalation. I think it was probably even greater because of the way we reacted to. Way the country reacted in Korea, we just backed off.
Mm-hmm.
And you just got, I think you, with the communists, in my experience in dealing with the communists is that you have to voice very clearly what your intentions are and that you're not afraid to, you know, react. I mean, if you come across this border, we're going to bomb you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have to voice your intentions very clearly. And, and they'll listen, you know. I mean, they're a very simplistic government. I mean, they understand force. That's all they understand. They're not used to politics because they control the media and everything else in their own country, so they don't care what they say. But I think there could have been some, you know, and he was dealing like, a lot of times he had a coalition. He had Australian troops, New Zealand troops. He had Korean troops there. And I'm sure he was having to, and then he was having to deal with the South Vietnamese also. But I don't know. I think at one point, I always thought at one point, I've never seen anything written about it since, but I know we were asked to get a lot of information about the North, information that you might use if you were going north on an invasion.
Hmm.
And And we did that for a while, and then it was like they backed off.
Mm-hmm.
I thought maybe that at one time they were thinking about it and then changed their mind.
Do you remember when, what time period that was?
It would have been probably early 67.
Okay. And what information were you asked to gather?
Oh, things about bridges, troop locations in the north, road conditions, how wide they were, a lot of things like that. Kind of just basic information that, you would get if you were going into a foreign country, you'd want, mm-hmm. I can't remember all the details, but I mean, there were a lot of different things that were just basic stuff that you normally could care less about unless you were going in there.
Mm-hmm. Now, the intelligence that you gathered, what would you estimate was the general size of the North Vietnamese force operating in Laos, just on the other side of Khe Sanh into Laos? How many North Vietnamese soldiers are we talking about when you were there in Khe Sanh?
Oh gosh, thousands. Well, see, most of the troops that we dealt with were coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and so they were transit. And what they basically were doing was just what I think they felt is, from an intelligence standpoint, was very valuable in Khe Sanh, was that we were identifying troops as they were moving south, so that we could tell them in advance that they were coming south and past us.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't really staying staying there. They may stay for a few days or.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that, but generally they were transit on their way south.
Okay.
There weren't too many until right before the siege started, maybe a year before the siege, they started building up troops there. But, I think they planned that siege for a couple of years, probably.
Well, then that would have been during the period you were there, because
right.
That was the siege, of course, started January of 68.
Right.
And you were there until June of 67.
Right.
So you did notice a shift, a change?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think with the where they moved the tanks up in there into Laos,
mm-hmm.
and, that had to have been a planned thing where they were going to come over and overrun the thing. I think they had plans. They thought they were going to overrun that Marine base,
mm-hmm.
but I think the air support was so powerful that they just, bombed them into oblivion.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they thought they were going to have another Dien Bien Phu there.
Okay.
But, that area was the Marine base was not a great defendable area because they were in a sort of a valley and the mountains were up around them.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as the Marines controlled the tops of the mountains. But we knew, I'd say at the end of 66, that they were starting to build up on the hills, 881 south, 881 north. We told them long in advance that they were building up there, but they didn't believe us.
Hmm.
I mean, I told the Marine colonel there at Khe Sanh, I said, they're building up big forces up on these hills. And he didn't believe it. Well, we don't see anything. We haven't run into anything. I said, well, you are. You wait. But he never believed it.
Hmm.
He never believed that. We nearly started not to. We gave it to the Marine intelligence and said, "You convince your colonel. We're not going to try to do it anymore. We ain't got time to mess with him."
Mm-hmm.
But we had a lot of information. There was a lot of good raw intelligence that we got up in that area, and I thought that we did pretty well. In fact, it used to be whenever I left to go back to Wei or somewhere like that, the Special Forces commander, is there anything I ought to know before you go? He thought maybe I was leaving because it was a big offensive coming. But, that was really, even the Special Forces camp in Long Vey, it was, that place was, I mean, we were all out there just hanging out there. There was no support out there, especially in the rainy weather. You couldn't even get a helicopter in there when the fog would come in and clouds were low clouds, and we're just, I was surprised the North Vietnamese didn't try to take us out long before they did up there in 68. Every once in a while they'd drop mortars in on our compound down right in the middle of Quezon, you know, shoot in there, snipers, stuff like that. You never knew exactly what they were going to do, but I was just really surprised. We always had an escape and evasion plan to get out of there if we were attacked, and so did the special forces. We stayed up with them for a while up in Long Bay, but they always had escape and evasion places because they were so outnumbered. I mean, most of these coming down, these North Vietnamese units, they were like thousands of men.
Mm-hmm.
And the special forces camp, it was just 18. They only had 12, 15 guys up there. And we only had two, so we figured maybe they didn't think we were significant enough to bother with
us. Yes, sir. When you said that they would rocket or mortar the compound, you're talking about in Quezon Village.
Right, uh-huh.
How often did that happen?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe every week or two, they'd drop some in there. You know, they'd hit and run.
Mm-hmm.
Because they knew we couldn't call in airstrikes. We didn't even have radio contact.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't even have a radio down there. So the only ones that could call in anybody would be the Vietnamese if they had some kind of radio, I think. But I don't know who the heck they call. There was no Vietnamese units there much.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, pretty much they just shot at will.
Mm-hmm.
They just drop one in there and move on. But they were afraid, you know, that the Marines would come after them because we could send somebody up to contact the Marines, and
mm-hmm.
and they might send a helicopter or something over there. But usually they were long gone, because we were about 5 or 10 miles from a Marine base,
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We were right in the middle of between Long Bay and the Marine base.
Okay. I asked you earlier about Soviets. You mentioned, of course, the Chinese threat. Did you get information or intelligence about Chinese movements in the area at all?
Not too much on Chinese. The only thing that we ever got that I can recall about Chinese were there. It seems to me there were some advisors up north that we'd get, you know, some information that they were advising them on maybe use of some kind of rockets or something like that. But not too much. The Soviets, we would hear something about intelligence, KGB. Or their military intelligence branch, which I forget what they call them now, but we would hear that they were down in Laos,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes.
Mm-hmm. You talking about the GRU?
Yeah, right, GRU.
Okay.
And that they sometimes were down in Laos, and I think I read an article from a Russian one time here not a few years ago that mm-hmm. they were talking about being over there, and they did, you know, I think they were just getting information from the Vietnamese, just gathering information. I don't
mm-hmm.
think they were pretty close. They were good for receiving information, but I don't think they gave the Vietnamese much information. You know, maybe a little military information about weapons and that kind of thing, but I think generally the Russians are kind of one-way intelligence at that time. They weren't. I don't think they were giving the North Vietnamese as much information as they had. I think they were just using them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Supplied them with weapons.
Pardon? Say that again.
They supplied them with weapons, the AK-47,
mm-hmm.
which is a good weapon.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you were to guesstimate, you know, just give a rough estimate. About how many North Vietnamese soldiers do you think moved south while you were there at Quezon from September 66 to June 67?
Man. Hundreds of thousands.
Okay.
I mean, they had convoys coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which ran along the border there at Laos and Quezon.
Mm-hmm.
And, we'd get divisions. I don't remember now how many is in a division, but we'd get all types of, I'd say hundreds of thousands.
Okay.
back and forth, going mm-hmm. both ways,
yeah.
because they, you know, they'd relieve, they get some relief and come back.
Mm-hmm.
And they used Laos's R&R Center.
Okay. Now, while you were in country, what kind of exposure did you have to U.S. media, whether it be magazines, newspapers, anything?
None. I didn't. I never saw any.
You never saw anything?
Mm-mm. Huh. No, well, we would avoid them anyway if we, you know, I mean, they would have never allowed them up around us.
No, I'm sorry, I don't mean the people. I mean the actual newspapers or magazines.
Oh.
Did you ever get, you know, to read anything while you were in country?
You know, I used to read the, they had an English version of the Vietnamese paper. I forget the name of it now. It was, I think, Saigon paper.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I was down there, sometimes they'd ship one up, we'd read it, you know, because it was kind of amusing, actually. And then Stars and Stripes, that's about all I got,
mm-hmm.
as I can recall. I couldn't even, when I was up there, I don't even think we could get an Armed Forces radio.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we were too far up. And sometimes we'd listen to some gal from Hanoi was on the radio. We had there was a psychological war unit up there,
mm-hmm.
and they broadcast some kind of stuff up north, and in Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
and they would receive sometimes. Sometimes we'd be around that radio room, we'd listen to what they were saying. They were playing music and stuff,
mm-hmm.
but yeah, they had a big radio tower transmitter there. They were sending up all kinds of propaganda up north.
So you wouldn't listen regularly to the propaganda coming from North Vietnam?
No, not too much. I don't know. We just didn't have time.
Yeah.
You know, most of the time we were out talking to people,
mm-hmm.
cruising around. The two lady missionaries that were there. They,
mm-hmm.
We originally tried to stay in their compound when we first went up there, but then they found out who we were. They wouldn't let us. But they, you know, they were friendly to us. We'd go down. One time I got sick with malaria, and they took me in, and they took me up to the Marine base. I got real sick.
Mm-hmm.
But
how long did that last?
I was real sick for a few weeks, for a couple of weeks anyway. I don't remember exactly how long it was, but it was quite a while. And I know I was in a kind of like a field hospital there, and then I went back and sort of recouped for about a month, I think. You know, I went back to Wei, and then I went down to Saigon, hung out down there for a while. And then because I had stayed longer, I got a 6-month leave.
Mm-hmm.
Not 6 months, 30-day leave.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back home, and right about that time when I was getting over it, I took my leave and went home.
Mm-hmm.
Then I came back.
When was that you went home?
March of 67.
Okay.
Remember, because it was my mother's birthday.
Okay. Well, while you were home for that 30-day leave period, what did you think about the way the U.S. media was covering the war on the home front?
You know, I don't think I paid much attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I came back and saw some of my friends and, you know, family and stuff like that. I don't think I paid that much attention to the... I didn't see that much coverage until when I came back for good. You know, I noticed then that, you know, there was... But then I was involved in a different part of the intelligence, and so I was right in the middle of the demonstrations and that kind of thing then. So, because we were investigating anti-war groups and all that kind of stuff then. But I didn't pay much attention. But you know, Virginia is fairly conservative. So, you know, I don't think that there was that much going on locally, anti-war, and the papers there were fairly conservative. So I think most of the stuff that was written was just about what was going on, you know, battles or things like that. And I don't even think I paid much attention to it while I was there.
How about national television coverage?
I don't even remember watching it, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I mean, I think I'd seen enough of it. I didn't need to watch TV.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So when you came back, did you encounter any kind of hostility by anybody?
No. No, not during the leave, I didn't.
Didn't see any anti-war protesters or anything like that?
No. I flew into, it was kind of a weird the way the deal, I flew into the Air Force base up in New Jersey. I can't even think of the name of it.
Travis? No.
Travis.
Travis, New Jersey?
Gosh, what was it? Fort, it was a fort up there in New Jersey, too, right next to
Fort Dix?
Fort Dix, yeah. But that's, we flew in there, got in there at night. It was snowing like crazy. I remember that it was a huge snowstorm coming. And when we got there, everything was closed. I mean, the airports were closed. And when you go up to this desk, and they'd say, okay, how do you want to get home? We'd get you home any kind of way you want. And so the only thing available was the bus. So another guy, he was going to Florida, so we went to Philadelphia bus. I guess Philadelphia is not that far from there. And we went to the Philadelphia bus station and caught a bus out of there and took that home. And by the time we got there, the snow had stopped. But it was, but no, we didn't. In fact, I remember sitting in the bus station. We had to wait a long time for the bus. And I was sitting in the, there was a long row of chairs there, and I was sitting there reading something, and this guy, he was like a homeless guy or something, and he was way down at the other end, and he was like moving one seat at a time. Next thing I know, the guy was sitting right next to me, so he's telling me, you know, I was in uniform at that time, and he says, I was in the big one. WW2. He's talking, you know, and I was talking to him a little bit, and he says, he starts telling me, he says, you know what a hoagie sandwich is? And I said, yeah. He starts telling me everything that's on a hoagie sandwich. And then he says, you know, right down the street they got the best hoagie sandwiches in the whole United States. He says, and they're selling them for a dollar, but all I'm asking you for is 50 cents. That guy spent an hour to ask me for 50 cents. I gave the guy a buck. I said, here, go enjoy your hoagie sandwich. But that was the only encounter I had, you know, I mean, with people. I didn't see any, at that point, any demonstrations. I think a lot of those were in California. Now, I saw them when I came back to California.
Okay. But there was that when you came back?
Yeah, the final time.
In later 67?
Yeah.
Okay.
But at that time, I didn't see any. I had my, you know, wore my uniform on all the way home. And I didn't see it. Nobody said anything.
Okay. Well, had anything changed when you went back?
No, not much. I don't know. My sister had grown up.
No, I'm sorry. When you left home from leave to go back to Vietnam, had anything changed in Vietnam?
Not too much. I mean, it's just more people.
Yeah.
You know, they brought in more soldiers from U.S. And of course, a lot of guys were asking me. You know, when I was at, I went up to Fort Dix to catch a plane back to Vietnam, and all of these guys, most of them were at a boot camp or, you know, advanced infantry training. Going over for the first time, you know, and they were asking me all kinds of stuff about it, you know, about the country and all that. I mean, they were, I think, anxious to say the least about it. And I had one guy I remember, well, they put me, because of my, I was the ranking guy in this group, they put me in charge of this barracks. And then you had to march out to this big parade area every day, twice a day, I think it was. And they would call off numbers. Everybody was assigned a number. And when your number came up, you went to the airport and went to Vietnam. But there were so many, they couldn't get them out of there quick enough. I mean, there was just so many planes. And there was a kid there. He came up to see me. I had my own room in this big barracks. And this kid came up to see me, and he was a private. And he was from Scotland. And he had come here as a alien or something. I don't know. I'm not sure exactly what his circumstances. But he had come here from Scotland. And when he got here, they drafted him. I guess if you were an alien at that time, if you came here as a permanent status, you were eligible for the draft. And he'd gotten drafted. And so he was talking to me and asking me about it, Vietnam and that kind of thing. And then he says, you know, this is not even my country. He says, I'm from Scotland. And he says, I think I'm going back to Scotland. And he says, I'm just going to leave. And I said, well, do whatever you want. You know, that's up to you. I guess I was supposed to snag him, you know. But anyway, the next morning I get up, and he's gone. He took off.
Whoa.
So there was some lieutenant there, young second lieutenant or something like that. And he says, you know, you had to report in each place. And I said, I got one guy missing, AWOL or something. So he comes over. He says, what's all that about? And I said, well, this guy called. He said, he's talking to me last night. He said, he's going back to Scotland. So then he starts raising hell with me about, you know, why don't you do something about the guy and all that? I said, hey, I just, you know, I said, look, I'm just a intelligence guy, man. I'm not any infantry guy. I don't do the, you know, I'm not into the marching people around and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he's giving me some crap. So I said, man, I got to get out of this place. This is too much. So I called the local Army intelligence. They had an office there at Fort Dix. And I called him. I said, man, you got to get me out of here. I said, they got me marching around over here. So I was on the next plane, gone. They called up, got me hooked up, got me out of there.
Okay.
But then I went back, and a couple of things had changed. They had a new 149th headquarters building in Saigon that I went through. I hadn't been to before. I went through there before I went back out to the field. But other than that, just more people. I remember it was a terrible flight going over because of there was just a plane with nothing in it, no movies, nothing to sit in it and fly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, for your last few months there in country, from the time you got back from leave to the time you left in June, were there any other major operations you participated in, or anything in particular stand out in your mind?
Hmm. Well, let's see. I think that's when they had the hill fights. They have 881 south, 881 north, something like that. That they had hill fights up there by the time the Marines were attacking, trying to retake the mountains up there. And they also overran the Special Forces camp briefly up in Long Bay while I was there. And they were attacking us some. I thought they were going to try to overrun us in Quezon. But they were able to retake the Special Forces camp. I don't think they overran it, but I think they held on or something. I don't remember now. And there was a lot of increased military activity there on behalf of the North Vietnamese. They were
mm-hmm.
getting ready for that offensive.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you receive any intelligence that led you to conclude that something was going to happen probably sometime in early 68?
I don't think I knew that it would be 68, but we knew that they were doing something.
Uh-huh.
And I think basically the Marines, higher echelon, ignored it. I mean, we told them long before when they had the hill fights that they were building up there, and they tended to ignore it. they seem to have a problem believing intelligence. I think they didn't understand how we received it, and they just thought that it was just, if they didn't see it, they didn't believe it. And that was, I think, one of the problems that they had, was that they just didn't believe their intelligence, and they allowed it to go on too long until they had built up so much that it was, they had a heck of a fight on their hands.
Mm-hmm. Now, during this time period, did you work at all with PRUs?
I don't think so. I don't think we did. I don't recall. Mostly we had those, what do they call them? Civilian Irregular Defense Group?
Yes, CIDGs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had those up there, and they were a ragtag bunch if there ever was one. But mostly, you know, we worked with the Montagnards. We had our own Montagnard operation up there.
Who worked with the CIDGs?
There was nobody up there. I mean, the only ones that I saw were, I mean, they had their own like little deal going up there, and then they had the province chief, who was a captain in the South Vietnamese Army. He had a little contingent of men there, and he sort of supervised them, I think. You know, I guess the special forces might have done, they may have done some training with them or something, but most of the time, they looked like to me, they were just guarding the district headquarters there. They didn't do too much. They just, they didn't wear boots, you know, because most of them were Montagnards. They were all barefooted, old, they had old guns and stuff like that.
Okay. Let's see. And when you were getting ready to leave in June of 1967, did they bring someone in for you to train up to take over what you were doing?
No, you know, it was kind of strange. I'm not sure what happened there. When they pulled me out, nobody went back. They pulled me out, and that was the end of it. As far as I know, nobody came in there, ever went back there.
What happened to your partner?
He went back around the same time I did.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I think he, let me think. I don't know if he went back before I did or after I did. I don't remember, but it was around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That he went back, and he was always trying to he was a little better at manipulating getting out of there than I was. He was always trying to figure out some way to get back to headquarters. So he spent a lot of time back there. He didn't spend as much time up there as I did.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay. And let's see, when you out processed and left, anything eventful happen?
No, not really.
Okay.
I think my battery on my phone here is getting a little low. It's beeping me.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. So.
Well, let's just, if we could press ahead, and we might be able to finish up before it dies on you.
Let me see. I think I got another battery in here. If you wanted to, no, I don't either. I thought I did.
Can you still hear me?
Oh, you know what? Let me go into my other phone. I got another phone in here.
Oh, okay.
A regular straight phone.
Okay.
And,
can you still hear me okay?
Yeah, hold on. How's that?
Okay. Yeah,
yeah, that's good. That'll work.
Okay. Well, you said that when you came back the second time, you know, in June 67, at the end of your Vietnam tour, things were a little bit different. Why don't you go ahead and describe that?
Well, it was a lot. I think the country had more of a, to me, a more impression of a just a big U.S. military fort. I mean, everywhere you went, there were lots of trucks, army trucks, a lot of army bases. I mean, just, I mean, the whole country looked like one big army post to me, and or Air Force base. Every airport was like an Air Force base. Just lots of people. You know, when I first got there, I think there were like 100,000 troops in the whole country. Mm-hmm. When I left, it was over 500,000.
Wow.
And it was just a big difference, you know, and everything. I mean, it just was such a military presence there.
Yeah.
And not only the American military, but the South Vietnamese, everybody in South Vietnam was in the military, men and women, just about. And then plus you had some foreign troops. You had the New Zealanders, Australians, Koreans. I don't know who else was there. A bunch of people. Thailand. You saw some people from Thailand there. So, I mean, it was just the whole country was just like a big military base.
And when you left and came back to the United States for that final time, how had the United States changed, if at all, from your previous leave?
Hmm.
You know, for instance, when you arrived in the airport here in the U.S., was there a
well,
different
Well, I came into California coming back, which was what was really interesting was when I went to Long Bend, which was the replacement depot for Vietnam, and so I went there to leave country, and while I was there, I ran into two guys I went to high school with, and we came back on the same plane together, all the way back, and of course, they hadn't been there as long as I had been, but they were talking about some things that changed back in Virginia, so, but when we got back to California, we came back, and there were a lot of, not a lot, but I saw, you know, some demonstrators outside of the Oakland Army Depot, because when we got there, they gave us new uniforms and stuff, and then the, which didn't bother me too much one way or the other, but when we got to the thing that I'll never forget, we got to the San Francisco airport, and we were on standby to get back to Virginia, and the we got up in line waiting to get on standby, and a bunch of students came up, and they had priority over military standby, and we didn't get on a plane. They got on the plane to leave, and we couldn't go. So that kind of ticked me off a little bit, but we finally got out of it. We spent a long time before we finally got out of that airport. Got back to Virginia.
Mm-hmm. How much time did you have left in the Army when you got back?
I had a year left.
Where did you spend it?
Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was with the 116th Military Intelligence Group, INTC Group.
What does that stand for?
Intelligence Corps.
Oh, okay, INTC.
That's the counterintelligence branch of the military. Intelligence.
What did you do with them?
Well, we did a couple of things. One thing is we did background investigations on people applying for security clearances, and then we did special investigations on anti-war demonstrations, Black Panthers, you name it. We investigated them. Martin Luther King, Poor People's March, all those kind of things were going on at that time. We did. We posed as. In some occasions, as TV reporters, that kind of thing. We had TV equipment and everything looked like reporters. We filmed anti-war demonstrations. They had analysts that would review the film of the anti-war demonstrations, and what you'd find out is that the people involved in anti-war demonstrations were like involved in a whole bunch of different other demonstrations. They really no one cause. They do anything that was a disturbance. Did a lot of investigations into the SDS, Students for Democratic Society.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. God.
When you say investigate these groups and rallies or protests or whatever, did that ever include investigations into specific individuals involved?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and we investigated the American Nazi Party.
Mm-hmm.
The guy George Rockwell.
Mm.
We had him under surveillance a lot in the American Nazi Party.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of different people they put under surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of thing.
Okay.
I think that was the beginning of the end of them.
Yeah, yeah.
60 Minutes did some kind of show on them.
Well, when you got back, as you were, you know, reintegrating yourself into, you were still in the military, but, you know, back into a U.S. society, as you were, I guess, being exposed to U.S. media, newspapers, magazines, television footage and all that, did you see, you were coming to this now with a different perspective. You spent over a year in Vietnam working in intelligence. How did that media coverage mesh with what you understood about what was happening in that country?
I'm not really sure exactly the media part of it, whether they were showing a lot of combat footage
mm-hmm.
and things like that, I thought I think I've always thought the media just they don't really give you a complete picture of what's going on, you know. I think they of course they're restrained by the amount of time they have. You know, everything to them is time, and they've got a 2 minute. To shoot a piece of film and show it to you, and it's got to be something that'll keep your attention. So they'll show the most exaggerated part of whatever they have. But I didn't. I thought when they got into the opinions, I didn't agree with it. I mean, when they were criticizing the military, the war effort, I thought that was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't agree with them in that end of it.
In January 68, when Tet hit, what did you think?
I wasn't surprised.
Uh-huh.
Well, I was surprised that it was so widespread. I wasn't surprised about the attack on Quezon and that kind of thing. But I was surprised that they were able to cover such a widespread operation, you know, in all the different villages and cities to coordinate it that far and not have information. Somebody had to have information on that.
Yeah.
I mean, they could have never got by with that without somebody knowing it. I just think somebody ignored it.
Mm-hmm.
That's my guess. I don't know any information once I left there.
Right. Excuse me. When you were involved in the investigations in the United States, though, does anything stand out in your mind as far as who was involved? Was there any kind of was there any evidence that you ever uncovered or witnessed that there were external forces acting on the anti-war movement, things like that?
Oh yeah, we had. Evidence that the KGB met regularly with leaders of the SDS and the other anti-war groups. They funded them, and a lot of their activities. And I mean, this was they were having a ball with this stuff, you know. And we had information. You know, these guys like Tom Hayden and Jane Fonda and all that group. They were, I mean, right in the middle of it. And Soviet KGB through their embassy representatives, I mean, they were just funding all of these operations and telling, you know, even directing them to some extent. I mean, it was definitely a lot of people say, you know, they try to say, well, it's, you know, just they weren't just students, they were just students who were being led like a mob.
Mm-hmm.
you know. And that's why a lot of times we had these films, there'd be some demonstration against something,
mm-hmm.
and the same guys that would be doing that would be demonstrating on some completely different thing, but they were still leading the demonstration, trying to get them violent. Like up in Chicago, that group up there, they were involved in all of that, supported by a lot of it. Some of it came through the Cuban intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
They were involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, they do the same thing we do. I mean, you know, when you look at it from, I guess as an intelligence person, this kind of stuff doesn't surprise you much because, you know, we operate the same way. And, in foreign countries, you know, that we're trying to take down, you just, you find a weakness and you probe it. And they were, and I think the Soviets had big, plans to take the country down. I think they thought that this would be the collapse. I've always given, Nixon credit for saving our government. Whether they liked his methods or not is one thing, but I think I always thought that had he not been elected president, that country could have had real serious problems. I think it was nearly out of control. They had all of these different groups and organizations that, you know, they were able to convince these people who probably really were against the war. You know, they just manipulated them like anything. We did this. We've done the same thing in other foreign countries.
Now, do you think that the American anti-war demonstrators and the American leaders, were they aware that some of the people they were working with were KGB?
The leaders of the
on the American
the movements
side, yeah.
Oh, yeah, some of them were. I know some of them were. And then some of them may not have been.
No, I'm sorry. But like you mentioned people specifically like Tom Hayden, Jane Fonda, and other major leaders
of the
movements. Did they know that these other people were Soviets?
They knew. Chinese, Soviet, Chinese intelligence.
Uh-huh.
I know, yeah, they knew. No doubt in my mind. They knew.
Okay.
Hayden and Fonda knew, I know.
Okay.
They were deeply involved. And there were some others, you know, I think like at, guys like at Father Berg and a lot of the big names all knew. I mean, they had to get money to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they got it. You know, that was one thing I always was disappointed that the press didn't cover that end of it, that angle, because it was very obvious, and even today they won't admit it. I mean, the press won't cover it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they should, I think. I mean, I think that was a very important part of our history.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think this country came closer to government falling than it did in the Civil War.
Mm.
I just think that it was, I mean, when they went, they had organized groups in these demonstrations. I mean, these guys were trained guerrilla fighters. They would go in, they would go with chains and run down the middle, down the side, each side of the street with these chains and break every big window in stores all the way down the street. And a guy would be running behind them with a Molotov cocktail, tossing them in, creating fires and things. The KGB, in fact, there was a guy, he was a KGB colonel with the KGB, even admitted that they funded all these organizations in a book that he wrote. I can't remember the name of it. I've got it here somewhere. But I was reading, I was real interested to see if he would admit that they actually funded them, and he does, that they did use, you know, that they used these organizations to create disruption in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they came very close to destroying the country. I mean, they used black organizations. You know, they would do things. Sometimes they were knowing participants, and sometimes they weren't. But they should have known, probably. But, you know, a lot of them were promoting their own cause, and they felt this was a way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say black, are you talking about African-American or covert?
Yes, African-American.
Okay. But they were also working covertly.
Yeah, sure. Some of them.
Now, what did you think when, as things evolved in the early 70s, Vietnamization, U.S. withdrawal of forces from Vietnam, and then the subsequent fall of South Vietnam to the North?
Oh, when I heard they were going to do that, I knew their time was days were numbered.
Yeah.
Well, mainly because, I mean, what happened was is that the North Vietnamese were being assisted by the Chinese communists, the Korean communists, the Russian communists. They were all being supported technically and with weaponry and finances and intelligence by them. And it was like a giant now was beating up on this little country. I mean, there was no way that they could survive. I mean, they were just, and they knew it. And I think the Nixon administration, they've pretty well admitted, you know, since that time that they knew they'd fall too. They just felt like they had no choice but to get out of there because people were raising so much cane about it.
What did you think when Saigon fell in April 75?
Well, I guess I wasn't too surprised. I was sorry to hear about it, and I felt like more than anything that we'd really betrayed the friendship of a country. I think sometimes it's one thing that this country seems to have a history of sometimes is not being very loyal to their friends, and I think that was one time. I mean, we just turned all those people. Look at the thousands and thousands of people were sent to these political re-education camps. All they were prisons.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, we just allowed that to happen. I was very sad about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm afraid we're going to do the same thing to Taiwan.
Mm. Well, what did you take away from your Vietnam experience personally, the most important things you took away from it?
Well, I guess it aged me a lot.
Mm.
I mean, I went over there as a 18-year-old kid, and I felt like I came back about a 40-year-old man.
Mm-hmm.
In experience, it was a educational experience, none that I would recommend to anybody, to be honest with you. I think war is a terrible thing. I mean, I don't think anybody can really verbalize the horrors of war. I mean, it's just I have a more critical eye anymore. I think when politicians talk about going to war and that kind of thing, I think I look at it in a critical eye because if you're not the one going over there, it's easy to send somebody else to war. But when you're the young kid that's got to go over there, it's not a fun thing. And I think that people, it's something that sometimes you've got to do. I mean, there's some occasions you've got to fight wars, but I just think it's something that you need to, that the government should prepare for, because this has happened in every war we've ever had. When the war is over, and it'll happen, I'm sure, in this Afghanistan thing, that some weird disease or Agent Orange type thing or something happens. I mean, there's always been, in the Gulf War, they came up with some kind of weird thing, and they're not prepared to take care of the veterans. And I think that, you know, that they don't have the facilities, and they forget about it. When the war is over, you know, they forget about the guys who fought in there and to take care of them. And I think that anybody, that Congress or a president that decides to send people to war, should be prepared to budget for the aftermath.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time. I mean, they should be prepared to bring, you know, I mean, national cemeteries. They don't have enough national cemeteries for veterans. They don't have enough VA hospitals, and the ones that they've got are in disrepair, and they're disgraceful, most of them. And I just think that should be part of they should be required to budget for that. And I don't know. People just I think they just forget about it after it's all over with.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a life changing experience. I mean, I think that it's something. I looked at different. I've seen interviews with guys from World War II, D-Day veterans, and World War I veterans that were interviewed and from war, and it's just something that you never get over. I mean, it's something that you will, as long as you live, you'll never forget it. I mean, it's just, it has an impact, and I would say in most veterans, their war experiences are the defining moment in their lives. I think that they, it has an effect that changes their lives for the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm.
Some worse and bad than others, but I mean, I don't think anybody can say they've been through war that it didn't have some effect on them. I mean, I'd never seen anything like that in my life, people getting killed and mangled. And I always go back. I remember my grandfather. He was a big supporter of the veterans' hospitals. I remember as a little kid one time, we were going to visit a relative or something, and he would always go to the local veterans' hospital and visit the disabled veterans in the hospital, and I can remember as a young kid going with him and seeing those guys mangled up, I mean, from World War I, most of them, and World War II, and, I mean, just unbelievable. I mean, just some of those guys, paraplegics, quadriplegics, and just, I mean, it's just awful things that happen to people in war, and the aftermath is, I think, as important as what happens during the war, but very little attention is paid to that, I think.
Mm-hmm. How would you say the Vietnam War affected you most?
I don't know. I guess it just maybe made me a more serious person.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it makes you a little more mature, mm-hmm. a little more thankful for what you have,
mm-hmm.
and that thankful that you come out of something like that without being mangled up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's some poor guys, man. I know guys that just just in. I mean, suffered terrible since this war. I mean, they're wounded, lost limbs, blinded. I mean, it's just something that those guys got to live with the rest of their lives. It's sad that that these things happen. Although it's sometimes necessary.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to discuss that we haven't covered today?
Can't think of anything. My memory's not as good as it used to be. I always feel very fortunate that I survived with it.
Mm-hmm.
I've had things that happened to me, and I don't know. I don't know whether it was a result of my service there. I've got diabetes that nobody in my family's ever had diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Now they say, they think Agent Orange may have caused Agent Orange and some of the veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Cancer doesn't run in my family, and I've had cancer operations because they think maybe that's the same thing. I think I'm in pretty good shape though, health wise now. My buddy who I served with, he died in the 70s from cancer.
Oh, goodness.
And they think it was from Agent Orange, they say. I don't know. But it's I just think there's a lot of things that you have to take in consideration when you decide to send young men off to war.
Mm-hmm.
And it just I think leaders don't consider all the repercussions of what they do.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to talk about?
Can't think of anything.
Okay, well, let me put an official end to this. Thank you very much, sir. This will end the interview with Mr. Jim Turner.